Your music just cut off.
Yes, we know. We're just going to start it over. Greetings, everyone. This is going to be all right.
Everyone, blessings to you this Friday night. This is Gianna speaking to you, my brothers and sisters of the light. We welcome you to this call tonight. They call this the Friday night history of Nisara call, I believe. Anyway, I welcome you to the call, and let us start with sacred circle, as we always do. So let us just go inside for a moment, if you could just drop what you're doing. And we're going to set the energy for this call and help to visualize that which is needed so that our Nisara, blessed Nisara, can fully be activated on this planet. So let's take a deep breath collectively and imagine ourselves gathered in a beautiful place on the land somewhere with a lovely fire in the middle. And as you take your place around the fire and sit down for a moment, let us just leave our cares and worries and concerns behind for a moment. And let us concentrate on the breath and on the heart chakra. So place your left hand on your heart and breathe. Let us take a deep cleansing breath When you change your breathing, you change your consciousness. It's all connected with the breath. So we inhale the life-giving, the life force, the prana, and we exhale what needs to be let go in our world, perhaps in our lives, all of us tonight. We certainly have a lot of concerns that we're all dealing with. It's been kind of a crazy week, all this stuff going on, Mercury retrograde, all kinds of funny things happening in everybody's lives. So we exhale out and we let go of those concerns. And we breathe in life, love, joy. And one more deep cleansing breath, holding it, and then letting go. Feel your bottom connected to the earth. Feel your legs. If you're like I am, the earth is very important. Imagine your toes on the earth in the beautiful green grass. And just connect with that electromagnetic field that is our Earth Mother. And as we do this, we thank this beloved planet. And we acknowledge her, her journey, her gifts, her suffering, all the things that she does for us every day. Gosh, we love this planet. It is so beautiful. What an exquisite, beautiful ball of greenness and blue oceans and blue sky and fabulous mountains and unbelievable animals and flowers. We are so blessed and gifted to be on this earth plane. There's a reason why we're fighting for the life of this planet. She is very precious. She is the place that healing is taking place for this entire universe. And each one of us came here with a reason, with a purpose, with a mission. So we thank the Earth Mother. Beloved Gaia, we love you. And let's reach up with our energy now and welcome Father Sky, the energy of the elders, the energy of our teachers, our ascended masters, the archangelic realm, the heavenly hosts, our brothers and sisters of the Star Nation, we welcome you to our circle tonight. And we spin the energy round and round. We reach out with our hands and we connect in a mighty circle and we surround this earth layer upon layer. And we welcome all of the fairy kingdoms and the devi kingdoms to our circle tonight, the furry ones, and the feathered ones, the fishy ones, all of the realms that are living on this beloved plane, this plane of Earth. And we thank all of you for showing up, for being part of our circle, and for being with us as this transformation, this ascension energy into the fifth dimension, the beginning of the Sat Yuga has begun in earnest. And so we are so grateful for everyone's participation, every role that we are playing. We thank you and we honor you. We respect you and we love you. And we ask for your forgiveness for any harm that has ever been done that we are responsible for. We thank you for showing up in our lives, for being part of this magnificent journey. So I'd like to just imagine that we have in this circle before us an electric blue flame, the energy of the mighty I Am Presence, the threefold flame of love, power, and wisdom, a pillar of violet fire. And into that violet fire, let's take a moment and let's place all of our concerns and our worries and our illnesses and the names of anyone in our lives that need our support and our love tonight. Let's take a moment and do that. And just imagine as that electric blue flame spins round and round, lifting the energies higher, it sends a healing vibration out to all those places that need our prayers tonight, to the children of the planet, to those in our family who have difficulties. I would like to place the name of my nephew, Grant, in a prayer for his survival, if it be his will and the will of his soul and the will of Mother, Father, God, Goddess, all that is. He's walking a very narrow road right now. We also place in the circle our dear Angel Sue and Harriet and Marita Robert and anyone else. I'd like to place myself in the circle. And anyone else that we can think of. I'm just going to be silent for a moment and let us do that for about 10, 15 seconds. Thank you. We know that this circle of support is continuously active 24/7, and we raise the vibration all the way to the cosine of Judah times 100,000 times 100,000 physically manifest, physically manifest, physically manifest now. And we call in Mother, Father, God, Goddess, and all the healers, the Reiki Masters and all of those beings to administer the angels, the archangelic realms, the ships, doctors, on behalf of all of those whose names we place in the circle, and all of those situations on the planet where there are wars and suffering and bombs dropping and horrendous things happening. So I'd like to share a few words. The last few days we've noticed how there are gatherings going on. Diplomacy shuttles happening all over the place, trying to stop wars from happening. And I would like to read something, a couple of things. One by Marge Percy and another one from Abraham Lincoln. And then I'd like to close with some words about peace. Councils, this is called. We must sit down and reason together. Perhaps we should sit in the dark. In the dark, we could utter our feelings. In the dark, we could propose and describe and suggest. In the dark, we could not see who speaks and only hear the words and what the words, what they would say. No one would speak more than twice, and no one would speak less than once. Thus saying what we feel and what we want, what we fear for ourselves, and each other into the dark. Perhaps then we could begin to listen. The women must learn to dare to speak, and men must learn to bother to listen. men must learn to stop dancing solos on the ceiling. I love that. After each speaks, she or he will say a ritual phrase. It is not I who speak, but the wind. Wind blows through me, long after me. It is the wind. I love that. I think that's a good idea. We should all come together in councils and turn off the lights, and everyone should speak one at a time and take the burdens off their chest and drink a cup of tea when it's all over with, and then we could perhaps move forward. And these words here from Abraham Lincoln about democracy: as labor is the common burden of a race, so the effort of some to sift their share of the burden onto the shoulders of others is great, durable, and a curse of the race. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy. Our reliance is in our love for liberty. Our defense is in the spirit that prizes liberty as the heritage of all people in all lands, everywhere. Destroy that spirit, and we have planted the seeds of despotism at our own doors. To those who deny freedom to others, deserve it not for themselves, and cannot long retain it. Let me say that again. To those who deny freedom to others, deserve it not for themselves, and cannot long retain it. Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in this world? Let us have faith that right makes might. And in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. I like those words of Abe. And this from the pupils of the Lincoln School. I read this before to you, but it needs to be said once more. Peace means the beginning of a new world. That's what we're building, folks. It means that nations are friends. It means joy to the world. Peace is quiet and calm. It is rest. It is silence after a storm. It is love and friendship. It is the world's dream of dreams. Peace brings comfort and happiness. It brings bread to the hungry. It brings prosperity to the nations. It means the strong respect the weak. The great respect the small. The many respect the few. It is like spring after winter. It brings sunshine into the world. It is like sweet music after harsh sounds. And that's my vision of peace. I love that. Quiet and calm and joy and prosperity and love and friendship. Let's hold on to these things and make them real and visualize them in our lives, because we can recreate this reality now. We are creating it. We're living it. And let us be it. And we seal this in the office of the Christ. And so it is. And I pass the talking sticks. Your beloved Rainbird. Namaste. I love you.
Hello? Hello, hello?
Oh, I think there's a little trouble with Rainbird. Rainbird, are you there?
I am.
Oh, okay, there you are.
I just got back.
Oh, okay. You were on a meditation run, huh? Oh, you were gone. Okay.
The line dropped somehow and just got back.
Okay. Thank you.
How's my timing?
That was very wonderful. Thank you, Deanna, so much. Yes, and thank you for coming back. Thank you. Pass the talking stick.
Thank you. All right. So, yes, thank you, Deanna. Beautiful words. So grateful for all of our lives. And I'm here to do the housekeeping. This is Rainbird. And so we are a listener-supported radio program. And we have supported better each week. And the update for today is we need $480, which means we're doing well. We're only a week and a half behind in some. So with much gratitude, we are continuing to ask for many donations from all these new people. And so that lightens the load for everyone. So no matter what size your donation, it is important to us. And it's real easy to do. This is the way we make a donation to BBS Radio. We go to bbsradio.com if you want to do this online. And click on Radio Station 2. And there are icons for the different programs for Tara and Rama and the Stargate Roundtable with Marita. So the Tara and Rama shows are the Hard News Call on Friday and the History of Nisera call on Saturday. Any of those icons will work for the shows, and they'll take your donation to the right spot, the right basket. So we call that a gifting basket, and as you can gift, we are so grateful. Whatever amount, that's what we're working on this week. And if you want to send a cashier's check or a money order directly to BBS Radio, that mailing address is BBS Network, Incorporated, 5167 Toyon Lane, T-O-Y-O-N. And that's in Paradise, California. The zip code there is 95969. So 5167 Toyon Lane, Paradise, California, 95969. And that's a good way to get it done as well. So much gratitude for all your efforts and prayers in this respect. And donations. It's such a good way to state your commitment to Nisera being announced. So it's a good way to take an action. So it is an opportunity for us to embrace. So thank you all for embracing it in a good way. We also assist Tara and Rama with their needs, and right now they need money for food and gas and some bills. And they did specify the money coming in first is going to go for the radio. So, but they do need some food and gas money. And the way you can send something to Tara Rama, a cashier's check or a money order, the address is Ram D. Berkowitz, R-A-M D. Berkowitz, B-E-R-K-O-W-I-T-Z. And that address is 1704-B, Llano Street, L-L-A-N-O, number 249. And again, 1704B, Llano Street, number 249 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the zip code there is 87505. Okay, and so as you're sending something through Tara and Rama, please email them at Koran, K-O-R-A-N, 888-999-at-comcast.net. Let them know. And also, you can make a phone contact with Marita at 317-773-0061. So that's all the ways you can make a donation. Also on the blog site, you can make a donation. So that address is 2013 rainbowroundtable.ning.com. And just click on the homepage. There's a donate button there, and there's one at the end of the blog section. So either one of those places will take you to Rama's PayPal account, and you can make a donation to them that way. And also, remember, they do great readings with through Mother Sekhmet, and it's a trio, Mother Sekhmet and Rama and Tara and tarot cards. So, or however you want to set up your appointments. I think they do counseling as well. So whatever, they are very willing to help you out in those ways. And for an exchange, for a donation. So you might consider that as well. So much gratitude for all of our lives and for this amazing time we're in. So much gratitude for Tara and Rama and the work that they do to bring us the news that they bring us, and all of their contacts, and just getting to know and be familiar with the real story out there in this world of illusion that we live in. So much gratitude to you, Tara and Rama, and I pass this talking stick. Greetings.
Greetings, everyone. Well met. I am kind of excited about what's happening. I mean, first on the list, and thank you, everybody. And we still have some bills to pay, so thank you. As there's money coming for food, and there's still bills, we are going to balance it out between bills and food, just so you know. And again, you know, the King of Swords is helpful in terms of, as you find it convenient, to just stick it into the PayPal. The King of Swords is helping to speed it up to get to us, so we don't have to wait that 5 day. We have a 5 day wait because we're not arranged in the way that others might be to get it a little sooner. Otherwise, but so we got that help. Just want you to know. And So send everything you can to the radio, because we want to make sure to catch up on that. We're doing a little bit every week. This is the fourth week, and we were way down there at 655, and then it was 610, and then it was 570, and now it's 480. Good, good, good. So let's keep it every week. Somebody else get inspired. This is making our love grow and making the Sara evolve in the good vibrations that Masara brings for all of us to know what this is about. I mean, Lady Nada and the King of Swords said this is the end of the line.
Yes.
And don't forget, the end of the line is just important. It's important as the beginning and the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So there are protocols, and I'm just saying that we found this through our sister Fran, of Fran and Susan. This lady, her name is Lotta Ray, and she was born in Russia, and she's traveled in something like 30 countries on most continents. She's an internationally certified feng shui master. And she's written three novels. Metaphysical thriller, The Earth Shifter, and a best-selling thriller, Gold Train, etc. She has extensively written regarding Russia, world cultures, geopolitics, empire collapse, feng shui and consciousness. And empire collapse is the order of the day, everybody.
Yes.
And the euro is going down. Hasta la vista. We're going to play something about James Madison, so we'll just be a few more minutes from
him. Okay. I talked today with Heidi and Tom the Cat, and they both just said the Eurozone is taking a nosedive right off the cliff, heading straight for the bottom. And it has everything to do with the fact that no more fake money. The market is still 17-something, and it's all completely fake. And it's just so amazing to watch the folks on CNBC who are basically trained to lie outright, like this reporter that was on RT that we played, where the entire media is trained how to talk about the stories on the planet that have absolutely nothing to do with reality. And the way Heidi and Tom the Cat put it is the 13 families are in serious trouble with the frequencies that are escalating higher and higher and higher each day. Yeah. Each day, they also try to burn as many bridges as they can behind them.
Let's see if we can end the Republic before the Republic can regain its stature.
Yeah.
That's the name of the end game right now.
And the way both of these folks today put it is, there is someone in this country that has a lot more money than the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson and Mitt Romney, and his name is Beloved Ascended Master Saint Germain.
Okay, we better go put this on.
And he is covering Elizabeth Warren's campaign.
Yes, and the other thing I just wanted to say, at this lady Lada said that this entire thing in Ukraine was rigged by the West, and it was, you know, different characters were pushed to go after this, and it's not Russia. Okay, let's do this. This is going to be a conversation with great minds of James Madison.
Well, I hope this microphone stays going here.
Yes, it will. It will, it will. Just tell him it's coming.
It's coming.
Agency that's under fire by the tribunal responded by saying,
for tonight's Conversations with Great Minds, I'm joined by award-winning author David O. Stewart, formerly a trial lawyer here in Washington, D.C. David is also the president of the Washington Independent Review of Books. He's written a number of books about American history, as well as a mystery novel, and won the 2013 History Prize from the Society of Cincinnati. David Stewart's new book, Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America, is a fascinating look into the friendships that made James Madison into the revolutionary leader that he was. David Stewart, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, did I have that Cincinnati thing right? It looked to me like there was a word missing there.
No, that was...
Yeah, okay, close enough.
That'll be
all right. You're a trial lawyer by training. What got you into writing history books?
Well, I usually say I loved practicing law for 25 years, and then I didn't. It was just something that came over me. And I'd always been engaged in writing as a lawyer, and I'd been a newspaper reporter. And I just sort of got the bug and decided I'd take a shot at it. I had an idea for my first book, which was about the Constitutional Convention, which came out of my law practice. So that was the way in.
What provoked you to study Madison's life and write this book about James Madison?
Well, I have done a couple of other books from the period, in dealing with the period, one on Aaron Burr and the one on the Constitutional Convention. And Madison's a fascinating guy, largely for the reasons you mentioned in the bridge. Terribly important. Arguably the only one from that era more important is George Washington. And yet he's often ignored. I think of him sometimes as the Zelig of the founding. He's always there, but nobody's paying any attention to him. And I wanted to unpack that and understand why and how he was able to have such a huge impact, even though we often manage to forget him.
Yeah, I think most people who even know a little bit about Revolutionary era history might think of him as the guy who took the notes at the Constitutional Convention without knowing that it was not like 5 years he took preparing for that, reading the constitutions of all these other countries. And
he was always the best prepared man in the room.
Yeah.
And he had been thinking about how to build a government, a republic, for at least 5 years. Yeah. and reading everything he could get his hands on.
Right. And then writing the Federalist Papers with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, and then becoming President of the United States after Jefferson, or as Jefferson's protege, as his kind of little buddy, you know, and they correspond with Jefferson.
You gotta watch that little buddy stuff.
Yeah. Well, he was also a very short man, and he was. But I'd never seen anything that suggested that he was self-conscious about that or was compensating in any way for that, the so-called Napoleon complex.
Well, he certainly had no Napoleon complex. He was not a grandiose figure at all. He was a reserved person, and that, I think, was part of just his makeup. And he was hanging out, frankly, with a lot of people with big personalities or who were just physically large.
Yeah. George Washington was like 6'2", wasn't he?
He was over 6 foot and a splendid athlete, and yeah, tremendous stature. And in his old age, Madison actually acknowledged that Washington had the advantage of a fine stature.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But, you know, Jefferson as well is a tall, good-looking fellow. Monroe was a big guy. So he was, and even though Hamilton was Madison's size, he had the panache and the spirit of a much larger man. So Madison could recede in the group.
Yeah. Hamilton had the swagger.
Yes.
Or the arrogance. I mean,
you could call it one or the other.
Yeah. Your book, the kind of framing device for the book is the subtitle, Five Partnerships That Build America, about James Madison's relationship with George Washington, his relationship with Thomas Jefferson, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with James Monroe, who followed him as president, and who am I missing? I think that's it.
Hamilton.
Oh, and Alexander Hamilton, right.
Yes.
And first of all, why choose that as the MacGuff, the tool, the plot, you know?
It seemed to me to explain a lot for me, which was he had to get the advantage of some of the talents that these other people had. He had remarkable talents of his own. He was often the smartest guy in the room. Frankly, usually was the smartest guy in the room. And he had a tremendous appetite for work and real political judgment and vision. But he wasn't a big personality. He wasn't a guy who could move large groups of people. Never a man on horseback. And I think he realized that if he were allied with such a person, he could have a much bigger impact. And so he was always open to that. And I became very struck by a statement by one of his longtime associates that Madison was always aware of what was due from him to others. Now, that's not something we think about with great leaders. Mm-hmm. We think of great leaders being very aware of what's due to them.
Right.
And Madison had a way of building relationships. Even, you know, two of these men who were his great partners, he ended up being political adversaries with. Both Washington and Hamilton he ended up opposing. But they still thought of him as a fine person. It never became personal. unlike some other figures who ended up very much at loggerheads, Madison could always disagree without being disagreeable. Yeah. So there was something in his makeup that I wanted to try to understand and help to explain his impact, because his impact was immense.
Reading his correspondences with Jefferson years ago, one of the things that struck me, and it's been almost two decades since I read this 20-volume version, you know, it took about a year that was published for the in 1909 by the Thomas Jefferson Society. But there was this fascinating correspondence between Madison and Jefferson about the role of church and state. And Jefferson was basically saying, if a priest ever becomes president, we're screwed. You know, if the religious people take political power, it'll corrupt government. And Madison was basically saying, if government ever starts funding, supporting, whatever, prompting churches, it'll corrupt churches. You know, Madison being concerned about the churches, Jefferson being afraid of the churches. Turns out they were both right. And Madison's first veto, I thought that was absolutely amazing. His first veto was to say that the money that from the Washington administration forward had gone from D.C. to the poorhouses here in D.C. would now go through a church. Madison said, no, I'm not going to allow that. This was set a bad example. What was his... was that issue of religion, church, and state? I mean, he invented the phrase firewall or wall between church and state. Did he not have wall separation? Or was that Jefferson?
I think that was Jefferson, actually, the serpentine wall. Madison, as a young man, was very focused on this. He and Jefferson both were, and were joint authors of the statute on religious tolerance, which Virginia enacted and was the first, really, in the world. And Madison really thought that the human conscience was sacrosanct and that government had no business anywhere near it. And that when you're talking about liberty, to him it meant many things, but that was the first thing it meant, was your relationship to the world, to a God if you chose to worship one, to any spiritual life, that's yours. And government has no role in it. And that was terribly important to him and throughout his life. And that was something that I think very early on bound him very tightly to Jefferson. They were soulmates from the beginning, but that was a key part of their partnership.
You write in the book about his wife's son, Jay, am I remembering?
Payne Todd.
Payne, thank you. And who was ended up kind of being a ne'er-do-well. Am I remembering correctly? I might be misattributing that it was Payne who directly confronted Madison about being a slave owner and was suggesting that he sell his slaves toward the end of his life.
I wish it had been. It was his secretary, who was really chief of staff, who was Dolly's cousin, a fellow named Edward Coles.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
Wonderful historical figure. Again, one we've forgotten.
Yeah.
Who freed his own slaves and took them out to Illinois, bought land for them. He only had a dozen or so, but he did it. Or maybe it was 18, 19, something like that. And he went back and said, Mr. President, you can do this too. This is so important. If you don't do something like this, it's going to tarnish your reputation in history. And you know, sadly, Madison, like Jefferson, was never able to figure it out. He certainly knew slavery was a terrible thing and a wrong. Mm-hmm. But financially, personally, he was never able to figure out a way out of it for himself or for the country. And he agonized over it.
Well, and if you go back to the Virginia Ratifying Convention and read the speeches by Patrick Henry and George Mason, where they were railing about how Article 1, Section 8 would allow a president who was an abolitionist to simply impress all of Patrick Henry's slaves, he was the largest slaveholder in Virginia at the time, to impress all his slaves in the military and thus free them, manumission without, you know, without an act of Congress. And thus the Second Amendment, you know, James Madison modified the Second Amendment three times in response to Patrick Henry. I mean, take it from the protection of a free nation to the protection of a free state and things like that. This is not in your book.
But the confrontation with Patrick Henry at the ratifying convention is a fascinating moment. And it was astonishing to find that in 1788, Patrick Henry to me sounded like a Southern demagogue of the type we would, Senator Bilbo, and was really saying, if you ratify this Constitution, the slaves are going to come get you. And boy, that was unattractive.
Madison wrote that he felt Patrick Henry was being paranoid. I mean, it wasn't the word paranoid, but words to that effect.
Yeah, he and Jefferson both found Patrick Henry impossible. I talk a lot about Madison's ability, gift, getting along with people. The one man he could never get along with was Patrick Henry.
Yeah.
And at one point it was so bad that Jefferson wrote in commiseration, well, there's nothing left for us to do with him except to devoutly wish for his death.
Wow. So, yeah, it's one of the great ironies of American history, I think, that the guy who said, give me liberty or give me death was the largest slaveholder in Virginia. And, it's like, boy, what a, and in all of these guys, their relationship to that institution.
The tension with slavery is very difficult for us to understand. We have to simultaneously recognize it as a wrong that they were part of, but also recognize that they were creatures of their time and the culture they were part of.
Absolutely. More of tonight's conversations with great minds of David O. Stewart right after the break. David O. Stewart, author of the new book, Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America. Let's just go through through these five relationships. I'd love to hear your story about, what's consequential, what's interesting, what might we not know about each one of these. Let's start out with George Washington.
Washington was the guy. He was the great hero from the Revolution and the great military leader. He was also a leader of real political judgment. He always had a great eye for talent, for the bright young man who could help him get things done. And he saw Madison as that person. They were 20 years apart. And Madison understood that Washington could get things done in the early American Republic like nobody else. His stature was unrivaled. So they agreed on many things, particularly in the 1780s when the country was really falling apart. They agreed that we needed a real government, not the sort of treaty-based system we had under the Articles of Confederation. So they made common cause through that entire period. When Washington becomes the first president, his closest advisor is James Madison, much closer at the beginning of the presidency than Hamilton or Jefferson. There's a wonderful sequence where Madison writes his inaugural address. Congress wants to respond to it. Madison's a member of Congress, so he writes Congress's response, and then Washington wants to reply again, so he has Madison write that. So Madison's talking to himself.
Right. He was Washington's ghostwriter, basically.
And he was everybody's ghostwriter. This is the period also when he writes the Bill of Rights, and it really is almost a solo performance, and it is Washington's stature that gets it through with Madison. So together they did great things. They did ultimately fall out. Madison ended up disagreeing with Hamilton's policies, and which Washington was following. But they were a tremendously important partnership.
Yeah, that was the Federalist, Anti-Federalist, Federalist, Republican, or Democratic Republican schism that Madison and Jefferson really led to the tail end of the Adams administration, or tail end of the Washington administration.
They
Jefferson
were starting
walked
it
out.
Even in the first term.
Yeah.
Hamilton's financial policies were just odious to them.
Yeah.
And drove them in.
Well, and which takes us to Alexander Hamilton. What was the nature of James Madison's relationship with him? Who was he? He's got a fascinating backstory.
Yeah, Hamilton's a wonderful historical figure. He's an immigrant. He comes from nothing. He just makes it on talent alone.
He didn't come from even an intact family.
No.
There's doubts as to who his father was.
There is dispute as to who his father was. His mother died when he was 13. He was orphaned. He made his own way just through sheer audacity. He was brilliant. A little could be erratic. He and Madison were the youngest men in the Congress in the 1780s, and they recognized in each other both mutually great talent, and they both agreed that, again, new government was needed, something other than what they were dealing with. So they made common cause. They were different people. You know, Madison was the fortunate son of a big landowner. He was a quiet man. Hamilton would be the life of the party, and he could jump up on the table and lead everybody in song if he'd had enough to drink. And Madison would be out walking in the garden with a friend talking. They were very different personalities, but they worked together very well. And most importantly, in the drive to have a constitutional convention, which they really pushed for as, you know, almost the intellectual engine room of the effort. And then, most importantly, the Federalist Papers, which they wrote together, which are really the finest political writing in our country ever, that Americans have ever done. It's an amazing achievement. They wrote some 80 essays. Hamilton, about twice as many as Madison, although Madison's have tended to survive a little better. But they just wrote them two or three a week. It was really a propaganda campaign to get the Constitution ratified. And it's amazing when you realize they were writing a couple of thousand words a week of usually good stuff.
In longhand.
In longhand, sometimes with the printer at their shoulder, waiting for the new copies. So, again, when Hamilton becomes Secretary of the Treasury, puts his policies in place, he and Madison don't see eye to eye. Madison goes into opposition. He becomes the leader of the opposition in Congress. But even 8 years later, Hamilton recommends that Madison be made the ambassador to France. He still regards him as a man of integrity, a patriot. They still have a relationship. So it's an interesting dynamic.
There's an almost cliche that, you know, we love to quote Jefferson, but we live in Hamilton's America. You look at the Jefferson presidency, you know, 1801 to 1809, and by that time he had, at least by the second term, largely accepted Hamilton's America. I mean, he was still talking about tariffs and to some degree, no.
Jefferson was a hard case. He didn't persuade easy. But the Bank of the United States, which was something that, you know, was a huge flashpoint, when it finally comes up for renewal in Madison's administration in 1811, Madison endorses it.
Right, and that was my question. Do we live in James Madison's America? Was that the hybrid?
I think when he became president, he understood some of the Republican dogma that the doctrine, I should call it, not dogma, that he had been part of, didn't work so well. You know, there had been a complete opposition to having an army. We were supposed to live only with militia. Well, when you get in a war with Great Britain and you're relying on your militia, you're going to lose. You actually need an army. And he realized we needed a navy to protect our trade on the oceans. So, and the Bank of the United States turned out to be a really helpful thing to have. So he had to come to terms with that they hadn't been right about everything. Mm-hmm. I think they were right about the nature of the government, the nature of the relationship between government and people. Mm-hmm. That was the most important part of what Jefferson and Madison made part of America.
Yeah. And the relationship that Jefferson and Madison had, how did that begin?
You know, it began very early in state government in Virginia. It's not well documented. There are early days. Jefferson was 8 years older, and I think when you're a young man, that's more significant than when you're an older person. But by the 1780s, they're just wonderful friends. They're both bookworms. There's nothing they're not interested in. They're curious about the world. They're smart about everything. And they just fire each other up. And they agree on a lot. They have some different attitudes, or habits of mind, which are very complementary. Jefferson's a bit of a visionary. He's not too good on the details. Madison's a bear on the details, and he's very analytical. And, you know, Jefferson would often get a big idea and send it to Madison and say, tell me what you think. And sometimes Madison would say, that's a great idea, but actually, maybe not. And other times he'd say, that's terrific. So they relied on each other and inspired each other. And they were a tremendous political team.
Dolly. Story of Dolly Madison and her relationship.
Well, I like to say that Madison may have been short, he may have been bald, he may have been skinny, but he had the hottest wife. And it's a great story. He was walking down the street, it appears, and this lady walked in the other direction, and he said, who was that woman? She was a young widow, and he got introduced to her by Aaron Burr, of all people. Courted her ardently. He was 17 years younger. He was in his 40s already and still unmarried. But then they were married for nearly 40 years, and it was a great match. Again, complimentary. You notice he tends to connect with the bigger personalities, and Dolly had a big personality.
You write in the book about how she would ask friends in Paris, one of them sent a $2,000, you know, what was it, a turban of some kind?
Well, feathers and fruit and everything.
It always stuck up so high that everybody knew where she was. In the
big social events, and they'd have one a week, Madison would just disappear in a crowd. I mean, he's small. And Dolly was larger, a little taller and a little broader, but she also would wear these big turbans with stuff hanging up, so you always knew where she was. Right. And you always knew where Dolly was, period. She was a great figure, and everybody loved her. I think when the Madisons left Washington at the end of his second term, most people in Washington miss Dolly more than they miss James.
Oh, that's interesting. James Monroe, we have about 2 minutes left, and he...
Hey, everybody. We'll do that 2 minutes when we get back. Very interesting. I have some exciting things to share. Let's do that on the conference line for this next hour at 860-970-0300. And the PIN code tonight is 232323#. See you there and at the top of the next hour at BBS Radio, best radio in the universe. Sat Nam.
Juga hati saja.
Sache, everyone. We are all servants of peace. All servants of thy peace. Our mighty I Am presence is all one. And greetings, Mother Alcyone. In the light of the most radiant one. In the office of the Christ, and only in the office of the Christ, we invoke the loving energies of Saint Germain and the Violet Flame. We ask at this time for the divine grace of unconditional universal love, for that which is not yet known, for the opening of the heart to go deeper and to be willing now to take steps into those unknown pathways of love beyond our
imagination. Gate, gate, para, gate, para, sangate, bodhisvaha. Beyond, beyond the beyond. Beyond the beyond, the beyond. There I am.
Yes.
Greetings, Alcyon and Mother. Greetings and well met.
There we are. We are all there in that goddamn place.
Gotta have that radio for the goddamn world
yes.
out there. Thank you. Greetings. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
So much shifting in the frequencies. This little blue-green speck has the attention of this entire universe. In this moment, it is how we get to be the 33rd member. Now is the time. Love is the answer. It is how we get through that keyhole, which is a black hole of divine love. It is in these moments where it may seem that there is nothing unknown. What is known is wherever you are, there I am. It is that I am, that I am. This is the answer to this whole picture in this moment. It's what's guiding the story here. Knows nothing of this funny little issue about the color of one's skin or scales or fur. The package is all unique unto itself. In a way, you could say we are bags of water at the level where all shapes, sizes of bags of water. And those bags of water, what you see in space is in those bags of water. It's the same. The cells are the same. The atoms, the particles. When we look at each other, whether we are blue with polka dots or green, or whatever, we are all the same essence. It is how we get through the keyhole of the black hole called ascension in this time. Changes everything. It is how we become the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. That time is now. Earth will not miss her destiny. Neither will you or me. It is this moment where this blue-green speck, it is her moment in the sun. And let's say it won't be stolen.
All right, greetings everyone. We're back. And for all of you on the Skype lines, I'm just saying we got on the conference line and a whole other can of worms showed up here while we've been behind the scenes here. Mr. Wynn did a number over there in paradise. I guess that's coming off the Pacific somewhere, huh, Don? I don't know. But nonetheless, the generators are on backup here, so we can go. And I think we should jump in with both feet and see what's happening here. Marianne Williamson is on Bill Maher's. She's a single one that's really getting down on the vaccine thing. And the other two are... Oh, well, we'll have fun with it. I'm sure that as time goes on, I mean, Bill Maher's is with Marianne Williamson. It's very interesting. But I just wanted to say a couple of things that there's a whole expose on Alfred Weber from the Kuala Lumpur judgeship that he did over there in The Hague. And he's a member of the Skull and Bones. And he's been attacking Kevin Annette from the International Sovereign Common Law Court. And then there's the fact that Poroshenko, he took his wife's last name, and that's not his last name. His last name is Walshman, and he's a Jewish boy. And he's got a dual citizenship between the United States and Israel. Ooh, this is getting hot. And then we're talking about him coming and trying to drum up war against Iran. And we just pulled up, just for everybody's knowledge, that from Professor Francis A. Boyle from Global Research, that in Article 2, Section 3 of the United Nations Charter, it requires the pacific settlement of the international dispute between the United States and Iran, where in that day and age when that was put together, pacific means a peaceful settlement, that it is against the law. Waging war against Iran is a criminal act. Mr. Bomb, 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 Bomb Iran, running for president against Obama, Mr. McCain, that's called waging war against Iran. And every time that the Bush administration has been trying to drum something up, it was a crime. Every single time. Throughout both administrations. And it's in violation of international law, and the death toll from World War III would be incalculable, and this is why this is a law. So that's a brief little tidbit of what we accomplished in a half an hour. And in the meantime, another little thing, this gentleman named Vincent Harris has found to be, and we'll go in, everybody's sending all these things to Rama's email, so we'll kind of get it. I repeat that in the hot news tomorrow. But he's a top aide for Rand Paul. He's based in Texas. But for the last 6 weeks, he's been working for Netanyahu's campaign to get him back into office with his Likud party. I smell a really big rat. Okay. In the meantime, let's go see what our brother Bill Maher's has to say. Thank you, everybody. Say welcome back, and thank you for your patience. Mother had to go. She's got a lot of work to do. She's a busy girl. Right, Mama?
Yeah.
Crowd to the hey, where are my out of towners? Anybody from out of town here? We've got the best in the country. Oh, I tell you, Disneyland's a mess. And it's not just the measles. Donald Duck has bird flu. Pocahontas has smallpox. The Little Mermaid has crabs. It's terrible. And the monorail, mono. So, no, this has become a big hot political issue this week. Rand Paul, you saw this, and Chris Christie, they both said vaccination should be a choice, not a government mandate. Because when have Republicans ever told people what they can do with their own bodies? That's just not who they are. But here's something interesting from the Republican side. The Republicans now are stoners who care about the poor. I don't know if you heard. A couple of weeks ago, they're all about the poor. And now it came out this week, two of them, Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz, admitted this week that they smoked marijuana in the past. Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time in my life, I feel like not using it. Don't be like Jeb Bush and Jeb Cruz. No, and I love this. Rand Paul called out Jeb Bush on his hypocrisy because Jeb Bush, you smoked pot when you were a kid, when you were in prep school, and then when he was the governor of Florida, oh, he opposed medical marijuana. He just wanted people to go to jail, no treatment, which is such stupidity because Florida, of course, is the perfect match for weed. Half the population eats dinner at 4:20. Now, what we don't know is about Jeb and cocaine, but we do know that he did once hand his brother Florida on a silver platter. he was talking about Christianity, and he said, you know, let's not get on our high horse here as we judge the Middle East, because after all, Christians have a checkered past. The Crusades, the Inquisition, we killed a lot of people. Slavery was justified with Christianity. Republicans were outraged, and I could see their point. A religious event is no place for facts. But, you know, what exactly do the Christians want us to say about history? The plants and the animals were designed by God personally, at his drafting table, like the dad from the Brady Bunch. But the Crusades just kind of happened. Slavery, not our fault. Africa was resisting arrest. And of course, this is all very sensitive this week because there's more barbarity from ISIS. ISIS is just topping itself with their barbarity. You saw what happened with the Jordanian pilot. Burned a guy alive. This time, at least, there was a reaction of revulsion from the Muslim world. I wouldn't exactly say they were up in arms about it. After all, no one was drawn. But they were pissed because, you know, beheadings, sure, we can understand that. Mass executions, crucifixions, okay, burying children alive, who doesn't? Ethnic cleansing. But this is barbaric and medieval. The Saudis said if they got the guys who did this, they would chop their heads off right in the town square. So that they will not put up with barbaric and medieval. But, and this other, the latest ISIS video, they found out, look, listen to this. They said it is way longer than previous ISIS videos. And it actually involves a storytelling narrative, at least four cameras, and advanced editing techniques. What are they getting in the movie industry? Boy, are they going to be pissed when they find out to get an Oscar nomination, you have to be white. But, you know, Jordan is notably pissed about this, and I'm glad they are. They struck back hard at ISIS, you know, bombing missions and so forth. And now ISIS says one of the Jordanian bombing missions killed an American woman who was over there in their capture. And Jordan says, nope, this is false. And Brian Williams says it can't be true. He carried that woman from a burning building. Brian Williams. Oh, Brian Williams is not having a good week. I don't know if you heard what happened, but it seems for the last 12 years, Brian Williams has been telling this war story where he's in a helicopter during the Iraq War, and it gets hit by RPG fire and goes down in a crash, which is all true, except for the part about it happening to Brian Williams. He was in another helicopter that was behind that helicopter that got hit. But come on, that happens to all of us. When we get older, come on, we misplace our keys. We have trouble with people's names. We can't remember if the helicopter we were in crashed. And now people want Brian Williams to resign, but it could have a happy ending because apparently what he said was such a blatant departure from the truth. Today he got an offer from Fox News. So it was an with Janet Mock. But first up, Amnesty International twice named him Journalist of the Year, once more than me. And his new book is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Johann Hari. Hey. How are you, sir? Great to meet you.
Cheers, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for coming across the pond. And you've written a terrific book on drugs, so obviously my first question is, are you holding?
Tragically not.
Okay. No, you're not. You're completely sober now because you went through your problems with drugs.
I'm right? Like Mitt Romney.
Not
in one limited sense.
Meaning?
Yeah. Meaning I'm like a Mormon. I don't use anything.
Oh, I see.
Sorry.
Not even caffeine or?
Caffeine a little bit, but today I'm trying.
Well, then you're not a Mormon.
That's true.
Yeah. So I got you there. Okay. So what I find most interesting about your book is that you say everything we think we know about addiction has been wrong. Is that right?
Yeah, it really struck me. You know, when I started working on this book 4 years ago, I had a very personal reason to do it. We had a lot of addiction in my family. One of my first memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And if you had said to me, what causes heroin addiction? I would have looked at you like you were a little bit stupid, and I would have said, well, heroin causes heroin addiction, right? We think that we've been told this story for 100 years that's so obvious to us, it's like our common sense, you know? We think if the first 20 people in this audience all used heroin together with us, on day 21, we'd all be heroin addicts because there are chemical hooks in heroin that our body would physically need. That's what we think heroin is.
That's what I thought.
Exactly. And
that's why I never did heroin.
Exactly.
So you're saying I could do heroin?
Well, the first...
Thank you for coming by. Now let's meet our panel.
The first thing that alerted me to the fact that I may not be right is any of us, if we step out of here today and we get hit by a car, God forbid, and we break our hip, we'll be taken to hospital and we'll be given a lot of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin, right? Mm-hmm. Diamorphine is much better heroin than you're going to score out on the streets. It's medically pure, right? As opposed to stuff on the street, which is contaminated and very weak.
Right.
You'll take it for quite a long time, right? Happening every hospital in the United States, every hospital in the developed world, lots of people are taking heroin for long periods of time. Now, if our old theory about addiction is right, we know what should happen. Those people should go out and score on the streets, right? You would have noticed that your grandmother was not turned into a junkie by her hip operation. And so I was thinking, like, how can this be? What's going on there? And then I didn't really understand it. I went and interviewed a man called Professor Bruce Alexander in Vancouver, who did an incredible experiment that helps us to really understand this. Basically, the old theory of addiction comes from an experiment that was done earlier in the 20th century. Really simple experiment. Anyone watching this can do it at home if they're feeling a little bit sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage.
Get a rat?
Get a rat, just buy one, take it from
that?
The sewer.
Who sells rats?
There are dealers for these things. And you get a rat, put it in a cage, and it has two water bottles. One is just water, and one is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself. You might remember there was an advert, Partnership for Drug Free America advert in the 80s about this, that said, you know, it will happen to you, or something like that. Bruce came along in the 70s and said, well, hang on a minute. We're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except take the drugs. Let's do this differently. So Bruce built Rat Park. Rat Park is like heaven for rats, right? Everything your rat about town could
where I buy all my rats.
It's got...
I go to Rat Park.
It's got...
Rat Co is good, too.
It's got... In this cage, it's got, like, coloured balls. It's got loads of friends. It can have loads of sex. Anything a rat could want, it's got in Rat Park. And it's got both the water bottles. It's got water, just normal water and drugged water. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water.
Right.
They almost never use it. They never overdose.
Because it has friends, sex, and colored balls.
Exactly.
Okay, so...
What Bruce says about that is it tells us that both the right-wing theory of addiction and the left-wing theory of addiction are on. The right-wing theory is it's a moral failing, you party too hard.
Right.
The left-wing theory is it hijacks your brain and so on. What Bruce says is it's not your morality, it's not your brain, It's your cage. It's an adaptation to your environment. And there's some really interesting human examples of that as well.
Human, same thing, put them in a cage.
That'd be a good idea, but same, very similar. At the same time as Rat Park, there was an experiment going on. It was called the Vietnam War. 20% of American troops in Vietnam were using heroin a lot, right?
Right.
And if you look at the news stories from the time, they're really worried because they thought, my God, we're going to have loads of junkies on the streets right. in the United States when the war is over.
So
what happened? They came home and they just stopped. Because if you go
so
from...
what are the implications of this for society if you're saying that heroin is not what we thought it was and people can do it recreationally?
There are huge implications, firstly, for the drug war, right? The drug war is based on the idea that the chemicals cause the addiction, therefore we need to physically eradicate the chemicals right. from the face of the earth. If actually the vast majority of people who use these chemicals don't become addicted, if in fact you've got to have a whole other thing going on, it makes sense to wage war on that thing. What we do is we actually make the real cause of addiction worse. We take addicts who are addicts because they're isolated and cut off, and we cut them off and isolate them more. I went out on a chain gang in Arizona with women who were forced to go out on T-shirts saying, I was a drug addict, and dig graves. They're never going to work again, those women. That is going to guarantee that their addiction is deeper. Gabor Mate, a doctor in Vancouver, said to me, if you wanted to design a system that would keep people addicted, you would design what we had now.
And the opposite is Portugal, right? I mean, I've been reading about Portugal for over a decade, what they did.
It's mind-blowing.
The opposite approach, and with great results, right?
In the year 2000, Portugal had the worst drug problem in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin. It was mind-blowing. And every year they tried the American way, and every year the problem got worse and worse. So they got together, and then they got a panel of scientists and doctors and said, look, tell us what will genuinely solve this. And the panel came back and said, decriminalize everything, from cannabis to crack, everything. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we used to spend on arresting drug users, imprisoning drug users, all of that, take that and spend it on really good drug treatment. And it's not drug treatment like we think of it in the US. Some of it is like rehab. Mostly it's about reconnecting addicts with society. Things like subsidized jobs. Say you used to be an addict. When you're ready, they'll go to a garage and they'll say, if you employ this guy as a mechanic for a year, we'll pay half his wages. The goal was to make sure that every addict in Portugal wakes up with something to do in the
This world. Is going to be a bit of a tough sell for Republican Congress.
To
give money to drug addicts?
I agree, but we've got to look at the results in Portugal, right? It helps us to understand...
I'm not saying it doesn't make sense. I'm just saying it's not going to happen here.
The results...
We're in a gun country, bud.
We put
you in jail, we fuck with you, we give you a gun, but that's not going to happen.
This was a country, it should.
I agree with you, it should.
Well, not least because of what actually happened in Portugal. Injecting drug use is down
right.
by 50%. No one's going to work, and it's really interesting. I interviewed the guy who led the opposition to the decriminalization. The top drug cop, his name's Joao Figueira, right? He said all the Fox News things, and there was a lot of resistance to this in Portugal like there would be in the US, right? He said all the things that a lot of your viewers are going to be thinking perfectly reasonably. And when I interviewed him, he said, Everything I said would happen didn't happen.
Right.
And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he was ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting drug users. And he hoped the whole world followed our example. And I really think, you know, the one thing you can say for the drug war is we gave it a fair shot, right?
Yeah, oh, more than a fair shot. And very enlightening. Thank you for telling us all this. Heroin after the show, everybody, huh?
Not
all right,
Johan.
Thank you so much. Great job. All right, let's meet them. She anchors Hot List on theblaze.com. Our old friend Amy Holmes is here. I don't mean to say our old friend. He's a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, John McCormick. Hey, John, how you doing? And she's the best-selling author and host of the Sister Giant Conference on Activating Conscience and Restoring Our Democracy on March 28th and 9th in Los Angeles. Marianne Williamson is with us. So let's first talk about the topic that's getting everybody crazy in America, measles, and what goes on here. And, you know, when I start these conversations, I always have to say, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, never have been. I'm an anti-flu shot guy, because I think that's bullshit. And I think the fact that it was 23% effective this week, bears that out. Okay, but, you know, if Ebola was here, I'd get the vaccine tomorrow. But let me just start before we get into the thing itself. The attitude of the media this week kind of pissed me off. It was just a lot of shut the fuck up. You know, it reminded me of the Iraq War, the first weeks. Just don't ask any questions.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that bothered anybody else. And then I was wondering what you think we should do about this problem of parents who may not want to do it versus the public good.
It bothered me because the implication was that if you had any skepticism whatsoever, you were anti-science.
And a kook.
Exactly. And I think there's a difference between having skepticism about science and having skepticism about the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that... I think that even though my child was vaccinated, I think that there is a public health issue that overrides individual liberty here, even though I don't want the government as a rule telling me what I can do and what I can't do with my body for medical purposes. At the same time, I think that the government has, as I said, earned our distrust. I think the pharmaceuticals have. And I think that there have been a lot of things. This is the problem when institutions lose their moral authority. We know that the government has suppressed information and withheld information. We know that the medical establishment has suppressed information and withheld information. So that at this point, even when they say something that we should listen to, people have a skepticism. And that's the real problem. This is what happens when, like I said, we don't believe our government enough and we don't believe our medical establishment enough. The answer is not to tell us we're kooks, but for them to get their act together so that they're more trustworthy again.
Matter, it seemed like a lot of gotcha politics, trying to make Governor Christie and Senator Paul look like kooks or anti-science. In point of fact, when it comes to public policy, states set vaccination policy, and 48 states out of 50 allow parents to opt out for religious reasons, and 20 states allow parents to opt out for philosophical reasons, including California, although that may change. Now, I'm not suggesting we should be praying in the church of Jenny McCarthy. I think that she's been incredibly irresponsible, and I think responsible parents would vaccinate their children, particularly for measles. And I was just talking this afternoon, for example, with a friend whose child is a kindergartner in Marin, and one of his classmates has leukemia. So for that family, measles vaccination is not theoretical. It is a matter of life and death. And I think those are the real issues to discuss, not Chris Christie going this way or that way about
vaccination. Really off the rails this week when he said he's known people who had who said they had profound mental disorders after getting vaccinated. And we know that the science is very clear in this. Vaccines do not cause autism.
Right.
They're not risky medical procedures. They work. Everyone should get their kids vaccinated for the standard regimen. Now, I think the media coverage was ridiculous in making this a Republican problem, because if you really look closely at it, it's more of a liberal problem. If you look at Hollywood, Berkeley, there are communities where 50% of the kids are not vaccinated. And when you get to that point, I do think you really need to look at possibly eliminating or at least narrowing these exemptions. I mean, what Christie said, that there should be balance, is what 48 states basically have, that there are these exemptions for personal belief or religious reasons. But when things get that low, I think you really have to look at getting rid of these exemptions or at least narrowing them.
Can I make one more point about the media that bothered me this week? The analogy that I see all the time is that if you ask any questions, you are the same thing as a global warming denier. I think this is a very bad analogy, because I don't think all science is alike. I think climate science is rather straightforward, because you're dealing with the Earth. It's a rock. I'm not saying I know how to deal with it, but climate scientists from the very beginning have pretty much said the same thing, and their predictions pretty much come true. It's atmospherics, and it's geology and chemistry, and that's not true of the medical industry. I mean, they've had to retract a million things because the human body is infinitely more mysterious. People get cancer, and doctors just don't know why. They just don't know why, and they don't know how to fix it. And they put mercury in my teeth. I remember my father had ulcers, and they treated it wrong when I was a kid. I could go on with all the times they have been wrong. So to compare those two sciences, I just think is wrong. Okay, let me ask you. Yeah, it's true. That doesn't mean...
I mean, there's an MIT professor, Richard Lindzen, who is a climate skeptic, and I would say that there are no serious professors who are vaccine skeptics out there that I've seen.
Can you name one MIT guy?
There are.
I
don't know about serious climate skeptics. I mean, the ones who are skeptics usually are paid off by the oil industry.
Pretty smart to get that.
Again, about this era we live in where we can't ask any questions, I'm going to ask a couple of questions. One is, even if we agree, and I think we all do, that vaccines are pretty much safe, and they certainly are effective, you know, they can wipe out diseases, can you do too much of a good thing? Because America loves to do that. We certainly went overboard with antibiotics.
to the point where, you know, we're going to live in an age, perhaps, very soon, very frightening,
yes,
where they don't work. I'm not suggesting the exact same things are going on with vaccines, but in 1983, they gave a third of what they give now. Is it limitless? Are there no amount that is too much?
Well, long before this story became such a big issue, many, many parents have been very concerned about this vaccine issue. And so, and I know I was, my daughter was born 24 years ago. So this is conversation has been around for a long time about this issue of vaccinations. And it's a matter of degree. It's a matter of the fact that all of a sudden we're taking all of them together in one shot. That's why people are talking about staggering them. And so absolutely, I think that this is, you know, I think that the doubt, you know, it is an upside of the American mind that we don't buy everything we're told necessarily. It's a downside when we think nothing we're told could possibly be true. So I think there's a skepticism which is actually healthy on this issue of vaccinations.
Well, there,
but on this one, the facts are in about measles, we had eradicated it,
well,
we need,
you know,
to get our kids
vaccinated. We compartmentalize things. They do very specific studies. Vaccines and autism. Okay, I accept that. But, you know, there have been no long-term studies about groups of people who get a lot of vaccinations versus groups of people who don't. I'm not so sure that people who get a lot of them have as robust an immune system. And there's an awful lot of maladies that we didn't used to have or have now in much greater numbers, you know, allergies and a lot more colds and ear infections and asthma and autoimmune disorders and chronic fatigue, all this shit. I'm not saying the vaccines cause them. I'm saying I think there's a lot of environmental factors that causes this shit. And if your immune system is not up to par, and, you know, when you don't use your immune system,
right. Well, you know, I mean, there's, you know, controversy, actually, of kids being bathed too often and being slathered in all of these, you know, right, all of that. And that is actually bad for building up their immune system. I think the science is in when it comes to measles vaccinations. I mean, I actually have a smallpox vaccination because I was born out of the country. And thank goodness, I mean, that we are eradicating smallpox as well.
But we're not arguing that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying we're not really looking at the bigger picture of this when your body doesn't get a workout. I mean, you know, I'm at the age now, 36. where they're suggesting, you know, maybe you should take testosterone, you know, added mm-hmm. testosterone. And they said, but, you know, if you do, just know that your balls shrink.
It's a trade-off.
I said, why do my balls shrink? He said, well, because you're giving your body testosterone so it thinks it doesn't have to make anymore. That is what happens in the human body sometimes. You
right,
know, when you ate it like that, it doesn't think it has to do the job so well.
Certainly, and there are concerns about women being put on birth control pills starting in the early teen years and having that in their systems for the next 25 to 30 years. And yes, I think we should have skepticism over these things, but we also have to look at the public health, look at the research, and make responsible
yeah.
decisions.
I don't think anyone's arguing with that. But to your point about trust, I made a list just literally off the top of my head about places where I don't agree with the medical establishment. I mentioned this to Dr. Gawande, who was here a few weeks ago. I've never heard of a doctor asking anybody, and no one has ever asked me, a Western doctor, when I went to them for anything, what do you eat?
That's right.
What do you eat? The thing that perhaps is most influential in whatever may be wrong with us, or maybe it's exacerbating it, okay. They address symptoms and not root causes. They're okay with things like aspartame.
Aspartame, yeah.
What is it?
Aspartame.
Well, whatever it is, it's shit. And I'm not okay with it. GMOs. Remember 5 years ago, if you said, I don't eat GMOs, you were a nut. Well, there's a lot of nuts now who at least want to know about GMOs. They overdid antibiotics. With the doctor a few weeks ago, we were talking about how not one country in the world does nearly the amount of surgery we do. I've heard on the news endless times, 2 drinks a day is good for you. I think no drinks a day is good for you. I think, you know, okay.
I have
one word, Monsanto. You know, who the ex-Monsanto officers are in our government. There's a revolving door going on there. And they love to also demonize things, you know, like the sun. Stay out of the sun completely. You know, cholesterol. Yes, I'm sure cholesterol is bad in excess, but you need cholesterol. Fat, you know, they'll tell you 1 week fat and then it's carbs. It's
it does make you...
There's a lot we don't know.
There's a lot we... Thank you. Unlike global warming, which we do know.
GMOs are pretty... It's a great force for reducing world hunger. I think that GMOs have been a huge breakthrough for the whole world.
Okay, but I'm not a starving child in Africa. Okay, yes, if I was starving, I would eat a GMO food. But that's not the case here.
What studies show that GMOs are harmful, though?
Okay. We don't know, and we don't trust Monsanto. If there's one company I don't trust above all, it is Monsanto. All right, I was going to start something else, but, you know, we only have a couple of minutes.
A couple things, though, that the medical establishment doesn't tell people who are sick, but I'm not sure you're going to like it either. People who are prayed for get out of intensive care units faster.
What?
And that people who are most
well, that is okay. true. Okay. That is true.
I believe that. That doesn't mean that the prayer is actually reaching God.
Okay, that's okay.
It just means that people have an ability to, yes, absolutely.
One more.
Great.
People who have been diagnosed with a life-challenging illness, who attend spiritual support groups, live on average twice as long after diagnosis.
Okay.
And that has been established by the most prestigious academic institutions.
There was also big science news from England this week. I don't know if you've heard the term this week, three-parent babies. I had never heard this term, but there's something called mitochondrial DNA, which can be a little fucked up in somebody. So what they've done is they take the good DNA, or that part of the DNA, from one woman and put it in the egg of the other woman, and then with the father's sperm, and they make a baby.
Was Sherry Shepherd involved in this in any way?
Why are you asking that? I don't understand.
Oh, she has the surrogate child that she now refuses to acknowledge, and that's a big mess.
It's like genetically engineered children.
Okay, so for people who are going to grow up with the three parents and want to know where they came from, I've written a short book called... Heather really has two mommies. Would you like to hear it? Okay. Because if anybody should be writing children's books, it is me. Oh, look at that. Okay, here you go. You asked where you came from, so here is your wish. Your special life began in a Petri dish. It's not a big deal, it's just a corrective. Mommy number one is great, but her shit was defective. So we put mommy's nucleus in the egg of a donor and fertilize it with sperm without even touching his boner. It was all science stuff. No kisses or hugs, no groping or touching or munching of rugs. Romantic it's not, but what else could we do when toxins have made a mess of your spoo? Rather than pass down a gene when we knew it was shady, we added a squirt of DNA from another nice lady. Mommy one gave the egg, of that there is no doubt, and Dad watched a porno and just rubbed one out. You might think the whole thing is ethically funky, but what's more like nature than spanking the monkey? Such a procedure would make Americans skittish, but a threesome without sex is totally British. All right, let's bring on Janet. She hosts MSNBC So Popular, an author of Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and so much more. Please welcome Janet Mock. Janet, great pleasure to meet you. First of all, congratulations on your show. It's on MSNBC.com. It's on Friday night. You have a panel. You talk about the events of the day. Where'd you get the idea?
I got the idea from Beyonce. That's where I got it from.
Really?
So, yeah.
Explain that.
No, I'm just kidding. I just make up conversations with Beyonce every day. We have a panel conversation segment called Today in Beyonce, where we just kind of talk about the latest.
She is in the
about her.
A lot.
She is, and Huckabee really has been helping out a lot.
Yes, so. He has. Mike Huckabee says what she does is mental poison.
Well, he's been poisoning me since I've been 15.
Yeah, so. he didn't get the memo that the culture wars are over, did he?
Or that it's not really for him. Sometimes certain cultural things are not made for certain people.
That's right. So Bill O'Reilly's always on about rap music, like he listens to it. But you're also the face, and a beautiful face, I might add, of the T in LGBT, which is a phrase I hadn't heard maybe 5 years ago. And I think half of America still thinks it's what they order at the diner at lunch, you know. But
LGBT.
there's still QQIA as well. So it just continues to adapt and change. And as more identities come forward and people kind of share who they are with the world, I think we kind of have new acronyms to kind of describe different people.
But I think that the transgender community, with the Jeffrey Tambor show that won the Golden Globe, Transparent, Obama gave it a shout out in State of the Union. I feel like, and tell me if I'm wrong, that you guys are having a moment.
There is a major cultural moment. I think there's a lot of visibility. I think what will be interesting is to see where this visibility leads in terms of validity and legalities. I know for me, in terms of as being a writer, I wrote Redefining Realness, my book, to kind of share my story and kind of be very, I guess, transparent about my experiences. I grew up as this young, low-income, trans girl of color in Oakland, California, and Honolulu, Hawaii. And so much of my experience, I think, mirrors the Black experience in America, the experiences of being marginalized, not even outside of your community, but also within your community. And I think the young trans girls need a story that kind of reflect them. And so that's why I kind of wrote the book. And I hope that my, I guess, my work overall empowers them and I think educates people who are not trans about...
It definitely educated me.
Did it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think I get it now that it's not that you changed or made a choice. You were born a woman. You just were born a woman with a penis and that thing had to go.
Well, yeah, from my experience, but many trans people don't have that same experience. Many trans women choose not to have surgery, right? Or choose not to undergo hormone replacement therapy. And so I think that womanhood can look so many different ways. And I think that what's so challenging, I think, for our culture to understand is that it largely doesn't have much to do with the body for certain people. For me, it was very much a part of my experience. I think a lot of it is social. I think that because gender is something that is visible, a lot of people feel uncomfortable with that visible change. And I think it also shatters a lot of people's categories, right? If we were born to kind of think that there's only man and woman, boy and girl, masculine and feminine, and someone comes in and is like, you know what? Fuck this entire thing. I'm going to gender fuck you a little bit. And I'm going to just blast your mind open and be this thing that makes you uncomfortable. I think that that's where the piece about self-determination and definition is something that's such a part of my work. And, you know, looking at the culture now, you know, I think we talk about Jeffrey Tambor. We talk about Orange is the New Black. We talk about President Obama mentioning trans people within the State of the Union as parts of people are Americans that we need to protect and care for because it makes us a safer America when we center the most marginalized within our discussions and within our policies. But another piece of that, you know, I'm flying in the airport coming here from New York City, and I see Bruce Jenner on the cover of every single...
Sure.
Every single tabloid.
Yes.
And what's interesting to me is that the subject of the piece in the story has not even spoken out at all, has not said
a single
word.
But he's going to. I think that... pretty much.
I think a lot of sources say, and we also know it's an interesting conversation in the sense that the one person that we need to hear from we have not heard from yet, and everyone's discussing parts of an identity that there's no definitions for yet because we don't know.
But he's clearly changing physically.
But we don't know how he's changing, right?
He's got tits. he has bigger tits now. I'm not joking. And he hair, and he paints his nails. And I mean, you know,
if
I came into work like that, they would talk.
I'm sure there'd be a lot of talk, but we don't know exactly what that body, how Jenner chooses to define that body. Jenner may say that they don't identify as a woman. They identify as something else outside of the binary of male and female. So we don't really know what that really looks like.
Right. There are 56 gender categories on Facebook.
On Tumblr, there's 1,000.
1,000? I mean, I can't even begin to know what 56 would be. Like, give me number 689. Because I think
that's by gender. But I think what's important about that discussion is wow, that those options don't affect your options.
No.
Right? It just you know what I mean? How I identify,
no,
whatever box that I check doesn't affect your boxes. You still have your
whatever
boxes.
Whatever blows
there.
Your dress up and whatever's underneath the title. So it's fine. Okay.
There can be many things underneath that dress.
All right. You mentioned President Obama. I want to talk about this because he was at the National Prayer Breakfast, and he was, I guess, talking about
religion and ISIS. I'm not sure what he got into it, but he got himself really into a bunch of trouble with the right wing because he said, lest we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place. Remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ. And that's why I love ISIS. No, he didn't say that part. But they acted like he said that part. The governor of Virginia said, the most offensive comments I've ever heard a president make in my lifetime. He has offended every believing Christian. Oh, Christ, drama queen much? I mean, these are facts. These are just facts. The Inquisition happened.
Right. But they're also non-sequiturs at the moment. We don't need our president worrying about European Christians from 800 years ago. We need him worrying about the beheaders, the immolators, the barbarians
that are marching across the Middle East. He can do both. I like he can actually sing what out.
But what does one have to do with the other is the question.
He's just saying that. Also, I've made this point myself a billion fucking times, that if I was living in the 16th century, it would be Christianity who I would be going after because they're the ones who are the most violent and the most intolerant. But we're not living in the 16th century. The problem with Obama making this statement is that he doesn't make the follow-up statement that I always do. We did it then, they're doing it now.
And that is the contradiction, that while he is placing that barbarity within the context of Christianity, he is not willing to talk about radical Islamic jihad,
right.
Boko Haram, and Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, that all say that their behavior is coming from their interpretation of Islamic text.
His
point was made at a prayer breakfast. He was speaking to people who theoretically understand the depth of nuance and theological discussion.
Right.
It is an important theological point that throughout history there have been people, including Christians, who were forces that appropriated religion for evil purposes. That is what the Inquisition was, and that is what is going on now with Islam. And I'm proud on this one. I do not agree with the president on everything, but I say God bless him. He had that depth to talk about.
It's not hard to appreciate.
You're so strange.
It's not hard to appropriate when the evil is right in the book.
But for many,
goodbye. What?
They're quoting from text,
yes.
And they're saying that our interpretation and reading of the Quran tells us to go out and behave this way.
And the Bible says slaves obey your masters.
Correct. But President Obama is not willing. He draws the equivalence without logically drawing.
He's usually trying to minimize and downplay this.
Yes.
Just earlier this week, before this immolation video came out, he said that 99.9% of Muslims reject radical Islam. The Crusades analogy actually doesn't make sense because that's suggesting the problem is really big because the Crusades, they are fought by true believers, widely supported throughout Europe, blessed by the church. And this is suggesting that,
what he said was 99.9% of Muslims are looking for the same thing we're looking for, order, peace, prosperity. Well, they may be looking for those things, but they're looking for other things too. We have different gods. Theirs is Allah, ours is money. This was the problem in Iraq. George Bush thought, we'll go over there and we'll bring them freedom and they'll love us. We'll greet us as liberators. But maybe the freedom they care about is in the next world because they take that shit so seriously.
The vast majority of Americans would not say that their God is money. They would say that their God is love, first of all.
Well, they'd say it.
And I have acted.
They'd say it.
And I
don't all live in your district.
This is what I don't understand about the point that you're making here and the point that you're making here. What is the purpose in making all Muslims wrong? What is
No one is doing that.
John Kerry said that these are a bunch of people who are just, they're motivated by alienation and poverty and thrill seeking. And a Democratic congresswoman, Tulsi Gabbard, a veteran from Hawaii, said, if that's the case, we should just go out and give them some skateboards and some hugs so they can feel good about themselves and they can get their kicks that way.
But that's not the problem.
This ISIS group, I have to tell you, they create a cognitive dissonance in my mind. I'll admit that. Because logically, I think we should let the Arab world, the Muslim world, take care of them themselves and get out of there. Stop giving a common enemy to the region. But I have to admit, they're very good at pushing buttons. When I see the things they do, like this week, I'm like, we have got to smoke these motherfuckers yesterday. I am
like, what is taking so long? And you know what's taking so long? No boots on the ground. Why doesn't Jordan have boots on the ground? Why doesn't Egypt, Saudi Arabia, why don't these countries have, what does it take for them to put boots on the ground? Take out your own trash.
Why don't we do a better job Why are we doing a better job of arming the Kurds right now? I think that's a real opportunity.
The Kurds do have boots on the ground, and they have suffered huge losses fighting ISIS. But the Iraqi army, you are right. They have run with their tail tucked between their legs the other way, and it is their wives, their children, their men that are getting murdered, thrown into ditches, raped, and crucified. You would think they would stand their ground. But what I would also add, though, with the problem of ISIS is that it is not contained within the Middle East. We know that France, for example, believes about 1,000 French citizens have gone to join up to fight alongside ISIS for glory and apparently raping little girls. Well, you know what? They have passports and they can come back. So we need to look at our policy in terms of not letting these Westerners go out there, gain these skills as terrorists, and come back and commit those same terrorist acts against their fellow citizens. You know what? I can't.
The ideal is the Arab ground troops, but what if it failed? Do we really think that if we leave them alone, they're going to leave us alone? They're not going to be another Charlie Hebdo every week in Europe, in America, something much
worse. I don't see
how us being over there taking care of the problem they should be taking care of and forestalling civil war. They need to have the civil war amongst themselves. If this doesn't get it started, I don't know what does.
The problem is they're so great at recruitment. You have Australians, you have Americans, French, Brit, all over there. And where are they going to end up when the war is over?
You know, when you were talking earlier, Bill, you talked about medicine and you said they treat the symptom but not the cause. And whenever we have this conversation about politics, it's always about treating the symptom and not the cause.
No, the cause is Islam. That's the thing. The symptom is what's going on.
Well, I don't agree with... I respect that you believe that the cause is all Islam, but I think that there's a multi-cause here. And for instance, if we had never invaded Iraq, if we had never struck this hornet's nest...
If we had never done that...
9/11 happened before.
There would still be millions of people who believe you deserve to die if you elope with the wrong person, draw the wrong cartoon, leave the religion.
But they believed that before there was ISIS.
Right.
They believed that before there was ISIS. You know, everybody's so horrified by these beheadings, which I am as well. We're horrified by what happened with the Jordanian pilot, which I am as well. However, there are other things we should be horrified about. There was no connection between 9/11 and Iraq. But there is a big connection between our invasion of Iraq and what is happening, including with ISIS. We should have some horror of national conscience.
We should have some horror of
knowing our part that we played in allowing this thing to explode.
Listen, there's a big problem. There's a huge problem. As we saw this week, when what we all regard as a barbaric organization puts on jumbotrons in Syria, the video of this young man being burned alive, and the townspeople are clapping and cheering. We have a huge problem here.
Bad apples. But can we talk about something important? What's going on with Brian Williams? You must have talked
about it.
Should he resign? And was this a one-time lie or a pattern?
I feel like it was kind of this magnified chain of telephone that he played with himself, it seemed. As someone who went to journalism school, I know when I was kind of in that space of studying journalism, our boogeymen were Jason Blair and Stephen Glass. We learned that plagiarism and embellishment is something that is on the same tenet of punishment as giving up one's sources. And so for me, if you cannot trust the white guy with the deep voice and the broad shoulders on your nightly news, who can you trust?
I think the Bryans... I think
you can trust Lester Holt.
I think the Brian Williams story is a huge red herring. Whether he should be fired or not, I don't know. But the entire American news establishment would be fired if telling the truth was the minimum standard.
Well,
I think.
Brian Williams seems like a really nice guy. He's got a great sense of humor, but I tell you, I don't have sympathy to begin with because I hate the nightly news broadcast so much because they abdicate their responsibility of informing the public.
Exactly.
Their newscast has about 4 minutes of news, and then it's bullshit and feel-good stories and the one-legged skier, and I don't...
I don't see how Brian Williams comes back from this, but how is this any different than what Hillary Clinton said in 2008 that she landed?
It's not. What about Chris Kyle, the American sniper? Who said he's killed?
who were glad to get back home and make love to my wife. He never left Culver City. Was he talking about get back home?
Well, in the case of Brian Williams, he is supposed to be the most trusted man in journalism, right, as NBC advertises. Yes. And it's interesting that these embellishments always tend to go in one direction, which is toward bravery and daring do, right?
Of course.
He doesn't say, like, I remember throwing up in the helicopter all over the pilot. Okay, that's not what he remembers.
All right.
He remembers being a hero.
Most of our news organizations are owned by just a few corporations. They always support the sort of corporatist line because,
right,
they are the corporatocracy.
Right.
They just let George Bush walk into Iraq with hardly asking him any questions. They don't talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They don't talk about Monsanto. They just
Because who does all the advertising in the nightly news? Big Pharma.
And now today they're all so serious, saying we take our responsibilities so seriously. Let's either laugh or get angry at the voting booth.
Last question. I got 30 seconds. Came out today, January, 257,000 jobs created, best three-month job total since 97. We always heard Obamacare, big job killer. Was it a big job killer? Was it really a big job killer?
The problem is you also have the lowest employment participation in 40 years. You have 30 million Americans who have given up looking for
work. But was it a job killer?
Even the CEO of Gallup.
Just yes or no. Was Obamacare a job killer?
They delayed the employer mandate, which is the part that's supposed to kill the most jobs. So maybe when that kicks in, we'll get to find out if we ever have it.
Well, at least there's an answer. Very good. Okay. I got to go to new rules. Thank you very much. Now that Puxatony... I know, why do I even need a rule for this? Now that Puxatony Phil has seen his shadow... Oh, wait, that's Donald Trump's head. I'm sorry, go on to the next one, you're right. New rule, Kim Kardashian must...
Oh my.
Kim Kardashian must cover that up before she really does break the internet. In Kim's latest photo spread, she appears to be outdoors smoking with no pants on. An image that appeals to men whose sexual fantasy is catching a homeless woman taking a dump in an alley. I don't know which is more embarrassing for Kim, constantly having to market her ass, or the cars lining up behind her waiting to see the drive-in movie. That's it. Now that ISIS has shocked the world by executing a prisoner, by putting him in a cage and burning him alive, Texas has to admit its reaction was, huh. Neural, now that Jeb Bush has admitted he smoked weed back in his salad days, Chris Christie must admit he never had any salad days. To admit, when I first heard the phrase Jeb Bush smoked some dope, I thought Jeb killed his brother. New rule, get a room. Enough with the trophy kissing before you suck the air out of that ball too. Guys, it's the Vince Lombardi trophy, not the Vince Lombardi rest stop. New Jersey people will be laughing, trust me. In New Jersey, with lightbulbs and things. Neural, when your news network is doing a special about the Holocaust, you have to pick a host with a less Nazi-sounding name than Wolf Blitzer. And while we're at it, you might want to rethink your look back at Pearl Harbor with host Tojo Kamikaze. Finally, new rule, now that many Republicans have come forward in the last week to finally admit that, okay, you were right, Sarah Palin is a crazy person, they have to ask themselves, what else might I have been completely wrong about all these years? Now, in case you missed it, Palin made a speech in Iowa a couple of weeks ago that cryptologists are still working on. Which I have been holding off on discussing, on the outside chance it might be brilliant in some other language. Let's look at a few moments, shall we, to see for ourselves what prompted conservatives to finally throw Sarah Palin under the bus.
He who was the one. Now, with tea time on the mind. Again, this is to forego a conclusion, right? It's to scare us off and convince us that a pantsuit can crush patriots. It's kind of Orwellian observing how that works, that rule of Saul Alinsky's, no doubt.
Boy, that really brings me back to the 80s when you'd get a chick back to your apartment to do coke and she'd do too much and start rambling and you'd think, boy, I made a huge mistake here. To be fair, Democrats make huge mistakes, too. Taking pictures of your dick comes to mind. Well, let's face it. This isn't a 50-50 thing. Democrats can be fuzzy thinkers, but Republicans will look you right in the eye and tell you that 2 plus 2 equals Jesus. But not anymore with Sarah Palin. The pundits who always defended her have now officially had enough. It was as if the scales fell from their eyes, and they were finally able to admit, the emperor has no clues. They called her speech incoherent, a farce, unseemly. Words that might have truly stung Sarah if she knew what they meant. For example, Matt Lewis, who previously had loved Palin so much he wrote an adoring book about her, penned a column titled, "You Betcha I Was Wrong About Sarah Palin." And said, quote, "Maybe her early critics saw some fundamental character flaw that escaped me." You think? I'm not saying Matt sticks with losers for a long time, but he wrote this on MySpace. But he's hardly alone. Bill O'Reilly compared it to a reality show. Sean Hannity asked, did the teleprompter go down? The Washington Examiner questioned whether she should be included in future Republican events. And Bill Cosby said, I wouldn't drug her with your drink. I made that last one. But hey, we're not here to gloat.
Oh, no.
We're just here to say, didn't that feel good to finally purge yourself of something that wasn't sitting well in your gut? It's like when you're sick and you make yourself throw up, you feel better afterwards. I only have one question for Republicans. What took you so long? The rest of us have been watching this dog eat grass for 7 years. But now that you know that you can do this, what about writing a column called, "You Betcha I Was Wrong About Climate Change"? Might feel good. Germany gets 74% of its electricity from renewables, and they don't live in the future. They're a real country. Turn left at Austria. It's right there. Look them up in a history book. They're always up to something. Or what about giving up on the idea of sending 12 million Mexicans back to Mexico? There aren't enough trains. Ask Germany. And as long as we're in a rethinking mood, you might... No, you know what might be a good one? Middle East invasions. Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria now, Iran, all these places you want to send heroic snipers. Turns out they don't like it. They're just not that into being sniped. And what about the great granddaddy of zombie lies, trickle-down economics? Can't we throw that one under the bus, too? It's never worked, and it never will work for a good reason. Because it's like having three dogs and giving a wiener to one of them and thinking, he'll share it with the others. All right, that's our show. I'll be at the Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara. On March 21st and 2nd. Oh, and we added a date at the Fox Theater in Oakland on March 28th. I want to thank Amy Holmes, John McCormick, Marianne Williamson, Janet Mock, and Johan Hari. Please join us on Overtime. Thank you, folks.
Everyone, hey. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You didn't stop them. And now they will make you pay. You could have said basta, but instead you said no more bashing. And now they're going to make you pay. Yes, you, every one of you, Every one of you and you and you in the airport and you in the hotel and you in your living room, you're going to pay. Hello?
Yes, we warned people about this headline. We warned them it was coming. I remember some of the mainstream media saying you were crazy about, well, 2 years ago for saying this. But banks may force clients to cover costs of negative Nordic rates. Back in 2012, when Denmark first cut its benchmark deposit rate below zero, commercial banks balked at the suggestion they could share that cost with retail clients for fear of losing business. Now, with rates even lower and the prospect of further cuts, banks are considering charging the people whose deposits provide their funding. So, you know, the ECB's deposit rate is now negative 0.2%, and Denmark cut its to negative 0.35%. This is the deposit rate for banks in the central bank depositing their funds there.
As we warned, there's been no deterrent. There's been no deterrent. That's to stop banks from committing fraud. There's no rule of law. So they're now in negative interest rates. They will charge customers money to park their money at the bank.
The first bank has not yet done it. They have charged institutional bank account holders, but they haven't charged the ordinary retail investor yet. And they've been reluctant to do that. But this is the most remarkable bit of this entire piece. And it is so important for everybody out there to understand what is happening in this sentence, in this next bit here. So banks, the article says, may now be less reluctant to pass on negative rates to clients thanks to surplus liquidity. The quote comes here. Banks don't have a need for deposits. The demand for loans by households and firms is weak, Niels Storm Steinbeck, chief economist at the Danish Bankers Association, said in a phone interview. The likelihood has never been greater that banks will pass on negative rates to customers, he said.
Well, I mean, this is remarkable because the banks are saying we don't need deposits and we don't need to make loans. Okay, they don't need to make They don't need to pay interest on deposits. They don't need deposits because the banks are giving them free quantitative easing cash injections to roll over their bad debts on their balance sheet that they acquired through committing fraud, massive fraud. They have these huge debts that are insolvent, but the government chooses to pay those debts. So they don't need depositors' money. At the same time, they're saying that we don't make loans. We don't make loans because there's no demand for loans. There's no demand for loans because of the deflation that's caused by central banks bailing out these zombie banks. So that they're at the center and they're the cause of the global financial crisis. And the fact is that if a bank is not paying on deposits, they don't need deposits. And if they're not, they don't need to make loans. Then what is it? It's not a bank, because the two things that a bank does is take deposits and make loans. Yes. If you have these banks saying we don't take deposits, we don't need them, and we don't make loans, then they're not banks. And we've been saying all along that they are not banks in the sense that they are fulfilling any kind of utilitarian value in the economy. They are an organized crime syndicate that is holding governments hostage and threatening to crash the economy unless the governments keep printing and giving them free money. That's called extortion. It's part of their crime wave.
But it also puts a lie to the fact that Mario Draghi says we need, he's just instituted this 1.1 trillion euros in quantitative easing, where this guy, this head of the Danish Banking Association, is saying there's surplus liquidity. We already have too much money. We already have too much money. The banks don't need any more money. We don't need deposits. So what is this quantitative easing about then?
It's about extortion, and it's about a fundamental lie. It's about government in the UK, Cameron, Osborne, and government across Europe and the United States believing that by giving banks excess and surplus liquidity, that somehow this is going to stimulate lending and create real organic growth enough to create the tax revenue sufficient to pay down the institutionalized long-term structural debt that countries like the UK and the US have. It's not happening because the banks simply take the money, they don't make the loans, and then they coerce governments to change laws to make it even easier for them to continue this massive crime spree. And now it's getting to the point where through negative interest rates, they're just going to confiscate people's savings account. It's a bail-in. Mm. In other words, in Cyprus, they did a bail-in. IMF, and, I'm sorry, MF Global and Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan did essentially a confiscation. They stole $1 billion. They confiscated that wealth.
But if it's done slowly, people tend to not mind it. So in Greece, people had their income slashed by 25%. Here in the U.K., it's been 8% over a similar time. It's just equally as bad, but here there's no sign of the sort of unrest that you had in Greece.
It's wealth confiscation. I mean, how is it different than in governments past? I mean, they were scapegoating people. They're saying that if you are not part of the Goldman Sachs partners, you're less than human. They dehumanize people, and they confiscate their wealth because they are engaging in dehumanization, the language of dehumanization. You're not human enough to have real capital, so we're going to attack you.
But also another issue that you and I have brought up many times here, and I noticed that others in the mainstream media are actually picking up, is this price signaling that central banks have destroyed price signaling, and negative interest rates are going to do that even more. Now, remember, Warren Buffett said he doesn't invest in gold because it doesn't pay interest. And others said, I don't invest in gold because I don't know how to price it because there's no interest being paid on it. Here, there's negative rates being taken from your savings account. Your dollars, your euros, your pounds are worth negative amount of money. So how do you value anything?
Yes, of course. Gold, silver, Bitcoin are all stores of value in the face of negative interest rates. And Warren Buffett is absolutely, again, another huge error that he's made over the years. He said some good things. He said some really stupid things. Yeah. And his comments about gold are, in this case, are particularly stupid because, yes, it doesn't pay interest. But then again, it doesn't confiscate wealth as what happened now at the bank.
Exactly. And in fact, they do speak to a banker who's afraid. They speak to a few bankers. Some are afraid, some aren't afraid to start charging negative rates to normal average Joe, you know, saving depositors. So this one says, but taking the unprecedented step will make clients angry, seriously angry, said John Norden, CEO of My Banker, which researches bank prices for consumers. Quote, they'll go to another bank or stick it under their pillow. Again, stick it under their pillow. They're putting it under their mattress. We have said long ago that why not just buy gold? But because it's not like, you know, in 1,000 years time, as happens here often, that some, you know, metals detector guy is going to, a detectorist is going to walk around and find your stash of paper money that you stuffed under your mattress, as is often done here. They find, you know, essentially silver coins, hordes of silver coins stuffed under somebody's mattress of old days. Well, this, and it's worth something today.
This proves even more starkly, in stark terms, my point that quantitative easing causes deflation. What could be more deflationary than confiscating wealth from the vast majority of the population who then cannot invest, they can't save, they can't spend, because that money's just been stolen. That's deflationary. So I ask again, is deflation either caused by these central banks and bankers who are at 0% interest rates or negative interest rates, or are they fighting deflation? They say they're fighting deflation. No, they're not. They're causing deflation as a way to keep their insolvent balance sheets from having to declare insolvency, and for all the executives at these banks having to find real jobs in the real economy.
And most importantly, though, they're counting on people being complacent. Look what they're waiting for. In this next and final quote here regarding this story, everyone's waiting for the first bank to start charging on deposits. Jesper Rangvid, a finance professor at Copenhagen Business School, said in a phone interview, quote, if the public says it makes sense, given the low central bank rates, then other banks will follow. But if they're screaming and shouting, then it depends on how long rates stay negative, he said. So if you respond with screams and shouts, they won't be able to do it. But if you're like, oh, okay, well, let's stop banker bashing. There's never enough basta. Like, you know, they're going to continue. They're going to take your money.
Look, in the old days, when you open an account with a bank, they used to give you a free toaster. Now they steal your toaster. They steal your house. They steal your car. They give you a disease. They give you, like, I mean, I'm sure some banks are going to start offering herpes. And, you know, open an account with us at HSBC. We'll give you financial herpes. And we'll take all your money, and we'll kill your dog. For HSBC, we kill dogs.
Well, five.
I mean, what kind of bank is this? What kind of deal are we talking about here? What kind of freaking shysters are these?
Okay, well, finally, in this deflationary spiral times, one bit of good news that consumers have, well, the mainstream media has told consumers that this is good news, is that cheaper oil will save you a couple tens of billions of dollars a year in the U.S. Well, cheap oil burns $390 billion hole in investors' pockets. Now that oil prices have fallen below $46, any euphoria over cheaper energy will be tempered by losses that are starting to show up in investment funds, retirement accounts, and bank balance sheets. The bear market has wiped out a total of $393 billion since June.
They've been saying for years now that you don't need interest rates above zero. Because you don't need savings, because people are saving in their asset accounts, which include house price speculation and speculation in oil. So now oil has collapsed. So that wasn't savings. It was not a savings account to speculate in oil at $140 a barrel. That's not savings. So now the same people are saying, well, in order to cure the fact that we were completely wrong about our definition of savings and completely wrong to steer you into speculative commodity investing and speculating, now we're going to put the cherry on the sundae by stealing your money through negative interest rates.
And finally, this is a great quote here that shows you the casino that it is. And it comes from Sean Wheeler, who is a Houston-based co-chairman of an oil and gas industry company. And he says, the only thing people are noticing now is that gas prices are dropping. People haven't noticed yet that it's also hitting their portfolios. So, you know,
because their asset prices are going to drop by 3-4 times more than they're saving at the pump. Net, they're going to lose. But I got, you know, 10 extra P at the petrol station. I'm going to blow on a Kit Kat bar. Yeah, I'm winning. All right, Stacey, we got to go. I got to go fill up my SUV. My Kit Kat bars.
Okay.
Stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Gettysburg. Author of this. What? Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Carrie Ann Mendoza, otherwise known as Scriptonite on her blog. And she's the author of this new book, Austerity: The Demolition of the Welfare State and the Rise of the Zombie Economy. It's now a top seller on Amazon, along with Thomas Piketty's book. Welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Good to be here, Max. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, congratulations. This is zooming up the charts. I think it's the right book at the right time by the right author. So we've got it all. So first of all, let's just get our terms straight here. So what is austerity?
So austerity is basically the transfer of wealth from the have-nots to the have-yots. It's about moving money principally from the public sector, from the kind of wider real economy that makes things and builds things, and moving it into the zombie economy, the debt economy.
When George Osborne talks about austerity, he's lying, basically, because he says they need austerity to reduce the debt. Yeah. But the debt's gone up, both the deficit and the debt. The deficit recently and the debt overall, Britain is approaching almost $2 trillion in structural long-term indebtedness. So that's clearly not the goal. The goal, as you point out, is more of a wealth transfer.
Completely.
Where some of the tricks. Now, in other countries like Greece, they finally said...
Enough.
So what are your thoughts on Syriza and their victory in Greece?
I think it's absolutely awesome. I actually wrote a piece this week actually comparing the outcomes in Greece and the outcomes in Iceland. We had two fundamentally different approaches in 2007-08 when the nations were in pretty much similar places. They were on the verge of bankruptcy, principally because of kind of banker debt. You know, you had Greece, which went the neoliberal route, took on austerity, it took the IMF loan, and the economy has shrunk every year since. You've got 11% of the population in extreme material deprivation. That means they haven't got enough to eat, they haven't got enough for electricity and gas. You know, this is real poverty, grinding poverty.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people understand that before 2008, the IMF was facing extinction, facing a debt crisis of their own, and that they weren't making enough dodgy loans.
Yeah.
So the Greek crisis, the 2008 crisis, came along just in time to bail out the IMF. They get
completely
back into the predatory loan business. And just on the UK front for a second, I'm having a bit of a digression. But I noticed that there was a recent clampdown on payday lenders like Wonga. Mm. I think that's a direct result of campaigners like yourself, Russell Brand and others. Yeah. Is that a victory?
It's a huge victory, and I think they're going to keep coming because it's essentially, you know, the zombie economy is not sustainable, and the more people that realize it, the more people that are hurt by it, eventually they start building alternatives. And that's what's starting to happen now, is we've gone through kind of the stage of protest, to just banging our feet, you know, banging our drums and looking to Parliament and saying, do something. Actually, people are starting to realize this group of politicians, these mainstream parties, are not the people. These institutions are not the institutions that are going to create a sort of workable alternative that works for the 99% rather than the 1%. And what's so exciting about that is you're seeing people then building these alternatives, like the kind of cryptocurrencies that you've been working on with Startcoin and all of that stuff. You've got, you know, the emergence of cooperative businesses, you know, where people are saying we no longer want these, where no one's really responsible. We want to actually work in a more cooperative way.
Yeah, I mean, and crowdfunding and cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
Just in the UK, we've got two political organizations on Startcoin using the cryptocurrency Startcoin. We've got the Green Party. We've also got George Galloway.
It's absolutely thrilling.
So
it's
they're
so
both
excited.
Crowdfunding and cryptocurrencies pushing back. And of course, let's go back to Greece for a second, because Greece was really, I think, the huge story that came after Iceland, if you know what I'm saying here. So Iceland, I want to talk about the zombie economy and get back to that. But first, would you agree that it was really Iceland set the stage for all of this? They pushed back against the banksters and the IMF and the crooks and the shysters and the Troika and the ECB. And then it kind of migrated to Greece. What do you think about this?
Well, one of the really exciting things about Iceland was it kind of was bottom up. You know, it was the people going, we are not going to do this bailout. We're absolutely not doing that.
They had a referendum.
They had a referendum. They brought in new politics. You know, they understood that it wasn't just about debt and it wasn't just about the financial services. It was the whole system that they were operating in that wasn't working, and that included their democratic institutions.
Remember, Greece was going to have a referendum.
Yeah.
And then they canceled it.
They did.
Because they realized, oh my God, they might vote us out. And now they've been voted out anyway.
Completely. I mean, that's the joke, is that you had the president of Iceland was asked, I think it was at Davos a couple of years ago, how on earth have you created this economic miracle in Iceland when, you know, the rest of Europe is in austerity and choking on its own debt? And he just turned around and looked at them and said, I ignored 30 years of neoliberal economics and I did exactly the opposite. You know, that's just beautiful. You know, they really got, you know, you cannot take the advice of a group of economists that not only didn't predict the financial crisis, but they told us it was impossible. Impossible, you know, economists that use, you know, economic models that don't even include time, debt, you know, in the models. And you go, these people, it's ideological. This is not a kind of anywhere near a kind of scientific economic process. You've just got ideologues saying, do this. Okay. The governments take the advice and then they end up in debt and so we.
Three words.
Yeah.
Rule of law.
Hmm.
I think what Iceland came down on the side of, the rule of law.
Yeah.
They said the banks are committing crimes. We need to put them in jail. We need to prosecute them.
Absolutely.
We need to close them down. We need to change the management. We need to respect the rule of law. It's not an ideological discussion whether it's neoliberalism or austerity or money printing or Paul Krugman versus Steve Keen.
Yeah.
It's about, are we going to respect any kind of rule of law? Yeah. They said, let's do rule of law. Let's get rid of the crooks. And as a result, they've had a brilliant, you know, recovery from having been hijacked by crooks. Greece came to the point of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
We want rule of law. Is the current finance minister and the current president of Greece, are they ideologues? Not really. Are they far leftist? No, not really. Mm-hmm. Are they any kind of political organization that is, according to the BBC, in league with the devil? No. They simply want rule of law.
Yeah.
Rule of law. Now, what about Spain? Is Spain going to be the next domino to fall and accept the rule of law?
I would expect so. I mean, they would be crazy not to. I think if they're looking at Iceland, they're looking at Greece. You know, personally, if I was in Spain, I would be voting for an anti-austerity party. And this is an exciting time to be a European right now.
You know what's amazing, Carrie-Anne, is that before Greece had this election and before the finance minister, Yanis, I'm sorry, I always kill your name. Before this all happened, people said, well, if Greece doesn't accept these measures, they'll be consigned to 1,000 years dark age of abject poverty.
It's the same story every time.
In the first few days, France said, yeah, we can accept a haircut.
Yeah.
All Eurozone saying, well, 50% seems okay. Like, they're completely false. Why? Because they're just bond sellers. They'll take any deal on the table. They're not finessing a deal. You know, if you default on one deal, they'll start a new deal. They don't get it. They don't care.
No, it's just the most absurd argument ever. I mean, there is not one single case in history of a nation applying austerity measures in a time of economic crisis and growing the economy out of it and actually, you know, with decent wages and everything else. It's never happened in history. You know, so and the very same people that told you, yeah, we should deregulate the financial services industry and business is booming and, yeah, forget about all of these unsustainable mortgages. It's all going to be fine. Those same people, that's the same people that are now saying, austerity will work. This is what we need to be doing. And it's just kind of like, at which point do you go, these people are crazy. Last time we took their advice, we ended up in like a global economic crisis. Why are we still listening to these people? And thank goodness you've now got members of the public that are saying, enough. You know, you're not going to turn us against each other. I mean, that's one of the most insidious things that's happened in austerity nations is it's the scapegoating, you know, this sort of resurgent fascism that happened in Greece. It's happening elsewhere too. You even got it happening here and the sort of a proto-fascist level with the UKIPers and the EDL, where people start going, oh, it's really bad because too many immigrants. It's really bad because the NHS, because scroungers. And it's kind of like, that was never the issue. It was not the cause of the financial crisis.
No, I'd like to hear Nigel Farage talk about rule of law.
He never talked about
rule of law. I don't think he's ever mentioned rule of law.
Well, completely. It's like, imagine if he said, we're going to stand up for British interests. You know, we're going to make sure that all of the Saudi Arabian money that is buying up property across London and inflating house prices, we're not going to have that anymore. We're going to reduce the property prices in London so that people who are naturalized citizens here can have houses.
Well, the whole UK has changed dramatically. You've got Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, England, and then there's a zone down in the southeast.
Yeah.
That's really a vassal state of Qatar. You know, they just bought the Canary Wharf. They bought the Shard. They're buying it all. It's Qatar. This is Qatar.
Yeah.
London is Qatar.
Yeah.
It's more Qatar than it is British.
I mean, it's crazy. And it's, you know, and even like the sovereignty issue with the City of London that you've got, where it's basically a self-contained state anyway. You know, it kind of has its own rules. It's got the Remembrancer, the guy in Parliament who's just allowed to sit there and watch everything, who, you know, works on behalf of the city. And, you know, there are so many issues right now that are going on. The idea that, you know, UKIP are an alternative because they're blaming the poorest and the most vulnerable people in the country for the ills is like, that's as old as the hills.
So austerity is a hoax. Osborne is a shyster because he's adding to the debt. He's adding to the deficit. There's no economic theory behind it to support these austerity measures.
None.
All they're doing is a wealth transfer from the many to the few. And we see the numbers. The few are getting tripling and quadrupling their net worth, and everyone else's standard of living is falling. Mm-hmm. You know, you do have a bubble in the real estate market, mm-hmm. but that's unsustainable.
Yep.
You know, especially when you see a lot of the geopolitical activities going on, including countries like Russia, well, they just pull out of their speculative money out of the London real estate market,
yep.
and that the top end is now starting to fall in. So that's very illusory. That's not savings.
No.
You know, in this country, they think that saving money, being paid interest on your savings, is evil. But speculating in the real estate market is quote unquote savings. Whereas saving, real estate market is speculation, is a vice, like gambling.
where savings and getting an interest on your money is called capitalism. You can't have capitalism without capital. You can't have capital without interest rates. Now, interest rates in 16% of all the sovereign, we only have about a minute. We may have to, can you stay over for a second segment?
Of course.
Okay, so let me just ask this question. So 16% of the global sovereign debt market is now negative interest rates.
Yep.
Like in Switzerland, where you have to pay the bank 1%.
Yep.
For them to keep your money. And they just take 1% out every year now. And 16% of all the sovereign debt is like this around the world. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that's the point of the zombie economy, is that it starts to focus more on making money for people who are speculators than it does on people who are trying to build things, who are trying to, you know, kind of, I think people have this kind of fairy tale view of capitalism that I think a lot of us were brought up on, which is the idea that, so, you know, you take something, you add some value to it, you sell it at a profit, and that's okay. We don't mind the profit because you've added value to the thing. In the zombie economy, it works entirely the opposite way.
Okay, yeah. Hold that thought. Zombie economy, we're going to pick it up from there. If you can stand for a second segment of Carrie Ann, that's okay.
I can.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Kaiser Report with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Carrie Ann Mendoza. She'll be around for another segment in our next show. Her new book is called Austerity, The Demolition of the Welfare State and the Rise of the Zombie Economy. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time. Bye, y'all.
These big turbans with stuff hanging up, so you always knew where she was. And you always knew where Dolly was, period. She was a great figure, and everybody loved her. I think when the Madisons left Washington at the end of his second term, most people in Washington missed Dolly more than they missed James.
Oh, that's interesting. James Monroe, we have about 2 minutes left, and he's another one of these presidents that people don't remember much about. Maybe that he helped ransom Thomas Paine out of France, but
it was a good moment.
Yeah, but it's like, what else did Monroe do? Oh, and there was that thing with Liberia, right?
There was, and the Monroe, well, that wasn't a great moment, but there was the Monroe Doctrine. He is important in our story, both because he was a great friend of Madison's, sometimes rival of Madison's politically.
He was younger than Madison.
He was 8 years younger, and a different personality. Crudely, he didn't have Madison's intellect, but he was smart enough for all practical purposes, and he was a man of great integrity. And Madison respected him a lot, and they were friends. In Madison's presidency, he had a terrible time with his cabinet. He could not get men in his cabinet he could rely on. It was a problem he had to try to explain in retirement. He said, you know, I asked people and they wouldn't serve. And finally, he was able to recruit Monroe to come in as his Secretary of State. And there were times when Monroe actually served both as Secretary of State and Secretary of War, really the most important jobs in the cabinet during the War of 1812. And he was a terribly important figure because he gave gravitas to the presidency, which Madison was not a military guy, not a soldierly figure. He needed somebody who could put that across, and Monroe lent that to him. So it was a great partnership.
Right. And in the last half a minute here, the War of 1812, how did that shape his presidency?
Well, it dominated his presidency. We were totally unprepared for the war. It didn't go well for the first year and a half or 2 years. We had some successes in the third year, and frankly, we're lucky to get out of it with a tie. And the country ended up feeling very good about itself, largely because of Andrew Jackson's Battle of New Orleans, but it worked all right.
It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks so much.
Brilliant book, Madison's Gift. To see this and other Conversations with Great Minds, go to our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And that's the way it is tonight, Friday, February 6th, 2015. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Don't forget, active tag.
We're very excited. My guest tonight, a very impressive young man, Wes Moore, author of a book called The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. Very, very excited to have him on the program tonight. But first, if I may, the 114th United States Congress is 1 month old. 1 month! Has the new Republican control changed the way Congress does business? The recipe for making legislative sausage, as it were? We examine it in our new segment,
Really?
I'm sorry, can we just, if we could just do something slightly. Do we have another?
The first one checks out Congress's sausage is the first thing, and the second one says, pokes around Congress's back door. Those are little subtitles. Sorry, you just had to tell you what was so funny.
Do we have another segment that I could?
Rectally penetrates Congress's asshole, and the two S's have dollar signs in them.
Oh my God.
I'm okay with the first one. Now let's get one thing straight. This isn't one of your lame, gridlocked 113th Congresses. Just ask Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
We need to open up the legislative process in a way that allows more amendments from both sides. Sometimes it's going to be meaning, it'll mean working late. But restoring the Senate is the right thing to do.
Hell. Sure, working late. Easy for you to say, Mitch McConnell. You carry your house around on your back, so you don't even need to go home. Because I believe, and I'm being completely serious right now, that Senate Majority Leader Mitchell McConnell is a turtle. What species? I cannot say. Although his native habitat being Kentucky, my guess is that the highest ranking Republican senator is either an eastern box turtle, a common musk turtle, or, I think this perhaps most likely, a river cooter. The six-term senior senator from Kentucky would like to provide evidence to refute this charge. Your move. Your slow, deliberate move. Perhaps you will allow me to sweeten the deal.
He's got a bag of grass, everybody.
I think Arby's just went, whew. But the point is, McConnell, in contrast to former Majority Leader Harry Reid, is allowing senators to propose whatever amendments they want to legislation. His first order of business was the Keystone Pipeline. I can only assume to use as a mode of transportation in his attempt to, seen here, catch Super Mario, utilizing some kind of... amendment policy paying swift and effective legislative dividends.
It is a extremely simple amendment. The effective language is only 8 words. Climate change is real and not a hoax.
That climate change is real and that human activity significantly contributes to climate change.
Republican Senator John Hoeven from North Dakota knew they put one in. It says the same thing, but taking the word significantly out. Why did you want the word significantly taken out of there?
Because, look, it was about finding that balance that will bring bipartisan support to the bill.
If taking out the word significantly was a way to bring Republicans on board, why not just draft the amendment as human activity contributes to climate change? Hey, remember Ronald Reagan? Wasn't he great? 3 cheers for the death penalty! Hip, hip, hooray! Well, listen, that's the Senate, where it's all passive-aggressive, I'm going to change one word type digs for open, unadulterated aggression. You got to drop by the House for the committee debate on the 9,000th vote to repeal Obamacare.
The administration hit the ball. Had the administration worked with the governors, we might be talking about an entirely different...
Had the administration worked with the governors, had the governors worked with the administration, we might not be in this position. I don't know about in your state, which I think is a crazy state to begin with. And I mean that just as I said it.
Hastings just straight up messed with Texas. That's the one thing Texas warns everyone not to do. Where's this ballsy young man from anyway?
The gentleman from Florida is recognized.
I thank you very much.
You're from Florida? You're from Florida and you're calling Texas crazy? Might as well call out Oklahoma for also having a panhandle. Hey, Oklahoma, nice panhandle sticking out of your state. Why don't you grab hold of your fugly ass panhandle and make me some pancakes, you extra appendage having piece. You're from Florida. You can't call other states crazy. You know, but that kind of flagrant text messing, well, that's not going to go unremarked upon.
But Madam Chairman, I made a very defamatory statement about my state, and I will not stand here and listen to it.
We are run by children.
Well, let's all calm down. I'm sure Congressman Hastings, he realizes he went a little too far. Let's give him a chance to apologize to the good sir from Texas.
Well, fine. Then you don't have to listen. You can leave if you choose. I told you what I think about Texas. I wouldn't live there for all the tea and churn.
He's crushing this dude. He doubled down. You don't have to listen. You still come from a crazy state. Although, I don't really understand the all the tea in China reference. I don't see how that's a positive. That seems more like a burden. That's a lot of tea. I don't even know where you keep that much tea. You really, you get that much tea, you're probably going to get crushed by a billion tea bags. They're not. All right. Two solid slams against Texas. Now, if Hastings wants to maintain a professional relationship here, I do think, out of protocol, out of respect, perhaps it's time for him to start walking this back.
I'd give some good attacks and invective being tossed my way. That's part and parcel of the territory. But there is no reason at all to impugn the people, the governor of a state of this country. And I will await the gentleman's apology, and I yield back.
You will wait until hell freezes over.
Hastings truly does not give a single just look at him sitting there casually reading. In fact, can we zoom in on what he's reading? No monthly. And what's that subarticle? Are you giving too many wow, some pretty harsh words there. But what if it doesn't end? What if Congressman Hastings just fired the first shot in what will soon become an all-out Florida-Texas conflagration? Texas first sends over some Rangers on horseback. Florida anticipates the move, sending out sexy spring breakers to distract them. Meanwhile, one man, Florida wrecking crew George Zimmerman, is parachuted deep into Texas territory. But before Zimmerman can stand his ground, he is taken out by Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw style. Then Florida retaliates by sending out an elite squadron of alligators high on the bath salts. Immediately neutralized by a Texas-released lethal cocktail of crude oil, mesquite, barbecue sauce, and Chuck motherfucking Norris. And then, when the shit's about to get really ugly, UT plays Florida in football and everybody has a big tailgate party and forgets about the war. Hook 'em gator horns, which is really a shame. Because you know who would have won a Florida-Texas war? The rest of the country.
The Daily Go is brought to you by the first ever...
All right. We have made it to the bewitching midnight hour, everybody. Oh, my word. I know it's 2 o'clock in the morning over there, yonder, east. We need to laugh in the face of what's happening right now, everyone. And you really got to be living under some rock somewhere, snoring, if the writing on the wall isn't in your face at the moment. And yeah, it's definitely it's time to go deeper, everyone. And you know, as Nathan the King said, they said Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald are going to still put those hundreds of thousands of sightings and landings up there when the time is right. We're going to have to sober up this place and come in here with all these monkeys in the zoo here. My goodness. Although they also said that they're looking down Ashtar's throat in the Middle East, you know, over there in Ukraine, I mean. As we discovered in English that Poroshenko is Velsham, a good Jewish boy with a dual citizenship in Israel and the United States. Keep on getting behind that veil. Speaking about getting, opening up the veil, let's look at what our fairies think of us here tonight. Okay, we're on the mountain fairy story here. And the last part that we read, an interesting sentence, I just thought I'd repeat it. They are very kind with sly touches of humor. Oh, good. And many are the times I have put my arms around them and petted them with affection, to which they have always responded. I have always often asked their advice about things, and it's they, and as they are so old, we're talking about the redwood fairies, the very are eucalyptus tree spirits. That's what they are. Those are very big trees, and eucalyptus. Oh boy.
Close the door. It's time.
Yeah, well, I think she can go out. It's not too late.
I'm tired of getting up.
Oh, you're tired of getting up. Meow, meow, meow. Kitty's got to stay in, everybody. And as they are so old, their viewpoint is permeated by a philosophy of life that has endured through countless ages of difficult circumstances. Their life has not been easy, and they have gained from the struggle. May we gain from the struggle, everyone. May we truly gain from this struggle. Still higher up there are some interesting fairies. They are of the same red color as the soil and have strange yet beautiful faces, surrounded by a silvery mist. After passing through their lovely company, one comes to the angel of the mountain himself. He is a large person, and for an angel, has rather gaunt features, with deep-set eyes of dark blue, a great and rather ponderous brow, cheekbones, high cheekbones, a nose of generous size, and a full mouth. The whole face, one of power and beauty. His complexion is that of a tanned human skin. His body enveloped in deep blue. I stood there before him rather respectfully. Okay. All right, everybody. We just took a little ferry ride here for a moment. Yeah. Mr. Wind is busy up to shenanigans. Climate change. Good for you. Good on you, Bill Maher. What a night. All right, we were talking about his complexion is that of a tanned human skin, his body enveloped in deep blue. I stood before him rather respectfully.
Oh, he's got blue skin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Krishna.
Yeah.
Yet naturally curious. And he responded very kindly in a manner which gave me confidence. He had a close feeling of kinship with his fairies and the animal and the plant life of his domain. And he also gave me the sensation of primitive power. He looked out upon the world around him with a feeling of having stood there so long and having seen so much that he lived in his memories. I think if you let her out, Rama, she's not going to come in for a while. She can play out there. Yeah, she says, you're being mean to me. These concern the strange people who lived there thousands of years ago. The convulsions of nature that had destroyed them. And the long array of tribes and strange beings and weird fairies which had come and gone around him. There are still some of these outlandish fairies in these mountains. Yet the hordes he once saw have dwindled. They look half human and half animal in strange hues of brown and red. Even peaks that are not especially high, yet are prominent and isolated, often have an angel in charge. For instance, I observed one at Mount Constitution in the San Juan Islands in Washington. This appears to be the highest point of land on an island which is fairly central in the groups. And from its top, there is a magnificent view over hundreds of islands on all sides. The sound in which the islands lie is ringed by several great peaks, some of them snow-clad in summer. Yet in this group, Mount Constitution stands isolated. The angel in charge is one of special power, remarkable in proportion to the peak. He is the guardian of all the islands and makes this point his main center. He has saturated it with his special atmosphere. Did you let her out?
No, I didn't.
No. He has both power and dignity, and is of a steady, slow temperament. Yet especially marked by kindliness and wisdom. He takes a remarkable interest in human beings, and has indeed a real fondness for them. He seems to have a certain scheme, which he is working out. He wants to maintain a special atmosphere throughout the islands, and this influences his fairies. It all makes them friendly. It also makes them friendly and helpful to humanity, for this is his wish. This is a little
microcosm of the macrocosm here, everybody. He has also established a feeling that there shall be no barriers. He has had a wonderful piece of good fortune because a state park has been established in such a form as to take in his particular peak and a large area around it. This is an animal sanctuary in which there are many deer and other fine wild things and magnificent trees. All this gives the fairies a very good opportunity to carry out the wishes of the angel. I think also that he has managed to impress many of his ideas on the human beings in and about the peak. For his genuine friendliness toward people enables him to understand, to overstand, and to guide them. I guess we'll have to finish this next time, but just one more sentence. Even human life on these islands is quiet and receptive because it is somewhat remote. So let's take ourselves there, everybody. Mm-hmm. And it is time now to pass this mountain angels, peaceful, quiet, receptive, open, long-stemmed Excalibur rainbow rose talking stick with emerald serpent feathers all around. And it's a Quetzalcoatl talking stick, too. Back to my sister Rainbird. Here you go, Rainbird. Oh, yeah, fairy dust. More fairy dust.
All that fairy dust.
Yes.
Yeah. All those emeralds.
Yes.
All that quiet. Now I'm too quiet.
It's the quiet it hasn't been around this world lately. Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
so
my
thank you, Kar.
Yes.
And Rama. And Mother Nafion. And BBS Radio. So much gratitude.
Spirit of the Wind gave us a few punctuations this evening.
Indeed. Indeed. So, what? So much excitement with Mercury in retrograde. And so that is that quiet time that's going within and listening to those inner messages. So I like that. So grateful to all the planets and the way they line up and shake us up. And a lot of gratitude to all these universes and the cheering squad that comes with them. You can do it. So thank you, brothers and sisters in space. And thank you, all you angels and fairies, for all your cheering and encouragement. We're grateful. We're grateful for all of our lives. So we're grateful for the love that is the instrument of peace. So, 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. And I pass this talking stick back to you guys. What you got for us, Rama?
It's got an interesting one tonight. This is called Moses Heard a Shepherd on the Road Praying. Here we go.
Moses heard a shepherd on the road praying, God, where are you? I want to help you to fix your shoes and comb your hair.
I want to wash your clothes and pick the lice off. I want to bring you milk, to kiss your little hands and feet when it's time for you to go to bed. I want to sweep your room and keep it neat. God, my sheep and goats are yours. All I can say, remembering you, is A and R. Moses could stand it no longer. Made us and made the earth and made the sky. Don't talk about shoes and socks with God. And what's this with your little hands and feet? Such blasphemous familiarity. Sounds like you're chatting with your uncles. Only something that grows needs milk. Only someone with feet needs shoes, not God. Even if you meant God's human representatives, as when God said I was sick and you did not visit me, even then this tone would be foolish and irreverent. The shepherd repented and tore his clothes and sighed and wandered out into the desert. A sudden revelation came then to Moses, God's voice. You have separated me from one of my own. Did you come as a prophet to unite? Or to sever? I have given each being a separate and unique way of seeing and knowing and saying that knowledge. What seems wrong to you is right for him. What is poison to one is honey to someone else. Purity and impurity, sloth and diligence in worship, these mean nothing to me. I am apart from all that. Ways of worshiping are not to be ranked as better or worse than one another. Hindus do Hindu things. Dravidian Muslims in India do what they do. It's all praise, and it's all right. It's not me that's glorified in acts of worship. It's the worshipers. I don't hear the words they say. I look inside at the humility. That broken, open lowliness is the reality, not the language. Forget phraseology. I want burning. Burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression. Moses, those who pay attention to ways of behaving, and speaking are one sort. Lovers who burn are another. Don't impose a property tax on a burned-out village. Don't scold the lover. The wrong way he talks is better than 100 right ways of others. Inside the Kaaba, it doesn't matter which direction you point your prayer rug. The ocean diver doesn't need snowshoes. The love religion has no code or doctrine, only God. So the ruby has nothing engraved on it. It doesn't need markings. God began speaking deeper mysteries to Moses. Vision and words, which cannot be recorded here, poured into and through him. He left himself and came back. He went to eternity and came back here. Many times this happened. It's foolish of me to try to say this. If I did say it, it would uproot our human intelligences. It would shatter all writing pens. Moses ran after the shepherd. He followed the bewildered footprints. In one place, moving straight like a castle across a chessboard. In another, sideways like a bishop. Now surging like a wave cresting. Now sliding down like a fish. With always his feet. Making geomancy symbols in the sand. Recording his wandering state. Moses finally caught up with him. I was wrong. God has revealed to me that there are no rules for worship. Say whatever your loving tells you to. Your sweet blasphemy is the truest devotion. Through you, a whole world is freed. Loosen your tongue. And don't worry what comes out. It's all the light of the Spirit. The shepherd replied, Moses, Moses. I've gone beyond even that. You applied the whip and my horse shied.
Okay. Hello, everybody. We thought we were counted in and we played the end of the other piece, but we're just going to end now. That's okay. The spirit of the wind has given us something to contemplate. But this, you'll recognize this song. It's a very beautiful song. So we haven't played it for a long time, and this will really help us. Here we go.
When the morning breaks and the sunlight warms my soul, in the east the eagle flies and the red tail proudly soars. I'm on my way to the place of a spirit one. Grandfather, hear me now, I am on fire. Let the Sundance guide my feet to your desire. Show me visions for my eyes. words like gold that shimmer in the sun. I look within to the shaman's mysteries. I'm on my way to die and live again. Grandmother Earth, I cry, give me rest. I take my place with a woman in the west. Show me the raven and the bear, way of herbs and the black obsidian. Hi-ya. 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 Turn toward the south like the water I will run. In innocence and trust, moonchild song is sung. I'm on my way to the place of a sacred plant. My emotions and my will at their command. The turtle's voice is heard upon the land. The wise coyote prowls. The rattlesnake will call me to the dance. Hi-ya, hi-ya, hi-ya. In the deepest night, the stars watch over me. Old woman of the north, my mind seeks clarity. I'm on my way to the place of the northern winds. Let the thunder and the lightning carry me. Lay my thoughts to rest and send me into sleep. Hawk and the buffalo, my dreams, white crystal magic medicine. I am.
Aya, everyone, that was perfect. I just wanted to share with you that Dr. Stephen Greer did a little walkabout here, and he was in Florida, way in the south, and it was around sunset, yet there were two starships, and they look like two golden suns, and they're right on the horizon above the water. So our brothers and sisters are most assuredly here. And I guess one more thought is that there is nothing that should not have been, because it was all called for every step of the way. And as Manly Palmer Hall was saying in The Origin of the Democratic Ideal, America cannot refuse the challenge of leadership in a post-war world. Mere physical reconstruction of ravaged countries and the reorganization of political and economic and social systems is the lesser task we will face. The larger problem and the great challenge is in how, and that great big word how, we set up a new order of world ethics firmly established on the foundation of a democratic idealism. Nasara now, everyone. This is the time. Now is the place. We are the ones we have been waiting for. In the spirit of the red-tailed hawk and the eagle, inshallah, we are another ourselves. And Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ah, homi takuyasin. Until tomorrow, I'll see you in your dreams and on that ship. We got work to do. Namaste, everyone. Mahalo.